psychological reasons.
Please call me.
From romance and investment scams to one targeting online holiday bookings.
It was actually over 1,800 euros.
Exposing the fraudster's tactics to help keep you safe. Scam Secrets starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Thursday lunchtime at 12.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Saturday, the 28th of March. This is Alan Smith. Good morning. President Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff has said the US is hopeful of having meetings with Iran in the coming days and that Washington expects an answer to its proposed 15-point peace deal. Yesterday, the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio said the war was likely to end within weeks, not months. In a speech to investors in Florida last night, Mr. Trump spoke about the conflict.
Now we're just going after targets. And they have no anti-aircraft. So we're just floating over the top looking for whatever we want. And we're hitting it. And we have another 3,554 targets left. And that'll be done pretty quickly. And then, at some point, we're going to have to determine what we do.
Intense airstrikes have continued across the Gulf. 12 US soldiers are reported to have been injured in an Iranian strike on a military base in Saudi Arabia. Israel has carried out fresh attacks across Iran, including on targets in the capital, Tehran. Analysis by BBC Verify points to evidence that the US carried out a deadly strike on a town in the south of Iran on the first day of the war with a precision strike missile. Iranian media says 21 people were killed. Merlin Thomas reports.
On the first day of the war, as children played volleyball in a sports hall, the southern town of Lamed came under attack. At least two missiles struck about 100 metres apart, hitting a row of residential buildings and the nearby sports hall. Visual evidence of the strike on the residential buildings has been analysed by multiple weapons experts. They said the footage likely showed a US precision strike missile was used. This is a new weapon, never used before in combat by the US military. CENTCOM, which oversees US military operations in the Middle East, declined to comment.
The drug safety regulator, the MHRA, says it will review the warnings given to patients who are prescribed some common medications which can cause impulsive behaviours. Investigations by the BBC have revealed that some people who were taking dopamine agonist drugs for Parkinson's, restless leg syndrome and other conditions developed sex and gambling addictions. The MHRA is looking into the patient leaflets included with eight different drugs. The chair of the Health Select Committee, Leila Moran, says the regulator should apologise.
I just can't even begin to imagine hearing what they've been through, abuse that they've suffered, financial ruin, all the rest of it that you've uncovered. And then to find out that they could have been so much better forewarned. I would love for the MHRA now to say sorry.
There's a warning that some pregnant women and cancer patients are facing life-threatening delays to ultrasound scans because of a shortage of staff to carry them out. The latest UK Census of Sonographers has found that vacancy rates have risen sharply in the past 6 years. The golfer Tiger Woods has been charged with driving under the influence after being involved in a car crash in Florida. His SUV rolled over when he attempted to overtake another vehicle that was towing a trailer. Both drivers were unhurt. Sheriff John Budenseek from the Martin County Sheriff's Office told reporters Tiger Woods appeared lethargic to officers, although he passed an alcohol breathalyzer test.
Our DUI investigators came to the scene here, and Mr. Woods did exemplify signs of impairment, but they did do some in-depth roadside tests, and when it was determined, he was placed under arrest and taken to the Martin County Jail. But when it came time for us to ask for a urinalysis test, he refused, and so he's been charged with DUI, with property damage, and refusal to submit to a lawful test.
Fire crews have been tackling a major blaze at a historic mill building in the centre of Leek in Staffordshire. The Grade 2 big mill was unoccupied but had planning permission to be turned into flats. People living nearby have been moved from their homes. There are no reports of injuries. That's the BBC News. We'll take a look at the papers in a minute, but first with an update on the weather, here's Sarah Keith Lucas.
Thank you, Alan. It's going to be quite a chilly feeling weekend. We're going to see strong winds coming in from the northwest, bringing us a cold air mass and plenty of showers, some hail and some hill snow in the mix too. For Scotland and for Northern Ireland this morning, we've got frequent heavy blustery showers, quite a bit of snow accumulating over the higher ground in central Scotland, about 5 to 8 centimetres through the day. At lower levels, they'll be falling as rain showers with some hail in the mix, could be the odd rumble of thunder too. And those gusts of wind are going to reach 50 to 60 miles an hour. So temperatures only 6 to 9, but feeling colder in those brisk winds. For England and Wales, most places are staying dry through this morning, but there will be some showers starting to move in from the north, and they'll drift their way gradually south throughout the day, tending to ease a little bit. So it'll be a day of sunshine and showers for England and Wales. Again, some of them on the heavy side, some hail and thunder in the mix as well. Top temperatures here around about 8 to 11 degrees, cooler in that wind chill too. The winds and the showers slowly ease as we head through tonight. It'll be a chilly night, but there will be more rain and winds moving south across the UK into tomorrow.
Thanks, Sarah. Time now for a look at this morning's papers, and many of the front pages focus on the war in the Middle East, 4 weeks on since the US and Israel first launched strikes on Iran. The Guardian reports that despite Washington saying it expects its operation against Tehran to end within weeks rather than months, Israel has said there will be no let-up. The I Weekend looks at the economic impact of the war after polling for the paper suggested half of UK voters were already tightening their belts by spending less on eating out, fuel and big purchases. Iran war shock hits investors' portfolios hard is the headline on the weekend edition of the Financial Times. The paper says global stocks and bonds plunged this month, marking the biggest combined sell-off since 2022. The Times says senior officials in Britain and Europe fear Washington could redeploy weapons from Ukraine to the Middle East in pursuit of what the paper calls a swifter end to the Iran war. The Daily Telegraph reports that Scotland Yard has reopened the investigation into the reported theft of a phone belonging to Keir Starmer's former chief of staff Morgan McSweeney last year. The paper notes that his phone records are subject to scrutiny because of his exchanges with Lord Mandelson, who was sacked as the UK's ambassador to the US. And reports that Keir is planning to offer a peerage to the Labour Mayor of London, Sir Sadiq Khan, has been picked up by many of the papers. The Daily Telegraph describes the move as an attempt to bring one of the Prime Minister's critics on side. And that's our look at the papers. This is BBC Radio 4, where now it's time to join Martha Carney for Open Country.
The sound of skylarks, and we're just 6 miles from Southend Airport in Essex. For this week's Open Country, I've come to Wallasey Island, which is a bird reserve run by the RSPB. I'm with Rachel Fancy, who's the site manager. And Rachel, this is a pretty unusual kind of nature reserve, isn't it?
Yes, well, we like it here. It's a lovely place full of wetland habitats that's been developed from an arable farmland over the last 10 years.
And you created it by getting earth from the London Underground.
Yes, so the eastern portion of the island was developed using the material from the Crossrail project, the tunnelling operation that created the Elizabeth Line, and 3 million tonnes of material was brought here by a boat in order to raise the land on the far eastern side so we could make some lovely mudflats and salt marsh.
So that was the point of it, was it, to raise the land?
Yes, definitely. Where we're standing now is below sea level. So if you just make a hole in the seawall, a lot of water would come on and off, and it was estimated to be about 11 million cubic metres of water every tide. And of course that would have an impact on the rivers around. And if through modelling it was reduced to 2 million cubic metres of water by using something to raise the land, then we were able to then make the habitats that we wanted and not bring too much water on each tide.
Do you remember that happening? Were you working here then?
I was. I arrived here to work here, and it was in the middle of Crossrail delivering their material. So it's a huge building site, dumper trucks everywhere, these ships coming in and out. And yeah, it was a sort of moonscape rather than the green reserve you've got today.
Moonscape, my goodness. Look, little egret just going past
nice.
Us.
Oh, nice. Just going down into the...
Now, I think you're going to have to explain a bit more about this, because the idea, most people think... have a seawall, keep the sea out from the land, that's a good idea. Why, from a wildlife point of view, is it not such a good idea?
So the seawall on that side was really quite low, so it could have breached by accident at any time. So it was nice to do it in a managed way. So we did build a higher sea embankment further inland and then let the other habitats develop with this new material. And for birds, you get the mudflats, which are really rich in invertebrates and good for bird food. And then it develops up into salt marsh, where the tide covers it for less often every tide. And then you get the plants developing and nesting habitat maybe for redshanks.
What kind of invertebrates are the birds feeding on?
So they love all the little worms in the mud, and some of them will peck flies from the surface. The waders that have the shorter beaks, and the waders with the long beaks will go right into the mud and get all the worms out from there. And there might be shells around that some of them crack open. And then in the winter, when you get a lot of annual plants on a salt marsh, so all those seeds get flooded out. And in the winter, when we get all the wintering ducks down, like widgeon and teal, they'll feed on all those seeds.
What's happened to the bird population here since you created the reserve?
So going from barely any birds, we've gone up to 40,000 wintering wetland birds here in the winter, made up of waders and ducks predominantly. And then in the summer, important populations of avocet, we can have 200 pairs, common terns, 100 pairs. And we also have a lovely little population of ringed plovers, so it makes us one of the key sites in Essex.
Oh, listen, it's the skylarks again.
Yes, we're really lucky at this time of year. We have about 200 pairs nesting across the reserve, so the sound of skylarks is constant at this time of year.
Oh, it must be so cheering for you.
Definitely.
Now, it's called Wallasey Island. Is it really an island?
Well, it's just an island every now and then. So on the northern side, it's the River Crouch, and then the River Roach comes around the east and the south. But where they meet at the corner, it floods the causeway onto the island just a couple of times a month when there's a spring tide.
And are there other islands, in inverted commas, like this in this part of the world?
We are part of a small archipelago of islands of Essex. So we've got Foulness Island just to the east between us and the North Sea, and then Potton, Haven Gore, Rushley Island to the south between us and Southend.
So what was it like here before it was a bird reserve?
So it was an arable farmland from the 1950s up until the RSPB created a nature reserve, and they would have grown wheat, rape, those sorts of crops in a very sort of intensive arable farming way, with the land drained, with north-south ditches running every 200 to 300 metres, and the water taken out to sea at low tides.
Keeping the reserve like this, maintaining the salt marsh, it takes a lot of management, doesn't it?
Yes, so some of it does. So some of it, the sea does everything for you. So those areas we were just talking about, but some of our saline lagoons, which are just behind that seawall, we are managing all the time to try and get the maximum for the wildlife and the birds that are here.
Well, let's go and find out a bit more about that.
So we're just going to walk down to the top of the saline lagoon where it feeds out into the River Crouch, and we're going to open it up in order to let some water in.
And the saline lagoon means it's partly filled with seawater?
Yes, that's right. Yes, so most of our lagoons here, because we're surrounded by seawater, the easiest way to get water in is to use that seawater. And the water used to drain out to sea through a pipe we're just about to get to. And now that pipe has been reversed, so we can feed the water into our saline lagoon.
Just down there I can see a couple of coots and a little white bit on their forehead.
Yes, they're going to start to pair up soon and build nests in the ditch right next to us.
And lovely to see the wind going through the reeds like that. We can see so far, can't we? Partly because it's a beautiful sunny day, but also because it's so flat.
Yes, very flat, like a lot of the Essex coast. Very few trees to block the view, a few bits of scrub edging some of the ditches, but otherwise, yeah, nothing to block your view for miles around.
And then lots of bits of wetland and so many birds I can see, little white specks on the grey blue water.
So we're just going to go and open up the gate just here and then over to those railings where there's a wheel where which we can turn to open the sluice. Okay, so if we open this wheel, turn the wheel, and it will open the sluice gate below us, and that will let water in and feed the lagoon beyond. So you just need to turn it anti-clockwise quite a few times, and hopefully some more water will start coming in.
I'm not going to flood everything too much.
No, I'll tell you.
Promise,
no.
Tell me what.
Right, so turning it now.
It's quite a murky colour of the water, isn't it? Slightly brackish brown.
And this water that you're now letting in from the River Crouch will feed that lagoon beyond.
I'm turning the metal wheel around. Is it lifting a sluice gate? Is it lifting a gate up?
It is.
Idea, yes.
Yes.
I've been doing this quite a long time now, apart from the workout. Am I doing the right thing?
You're doing the right thing. You can probably stop about now. That's usually about how much we have it open. But yeah, it does save you going to the gym later.
Well, I've come to an even more remote part of Wallasey Island, to a place that's called Schoolhouse Lookout. And what I'm looking out at is Jubilee Marsh, which was created as a result of the Crossrail project. And I'm with Jeff Delve, who's a volunteer here. In fact, you've been volunteering for quite a long time, haven't you? Tour groups here as well.
I have, way back. And then as the main project came online, I've been involved right the way through. So mainly representing the local birdwatching community here, which has been fantastic. And it's so nice of them to build it on my doorstep.
What we're looking at here is the tide coming in, nearly at high tide, aren't we? And so there's a big expanse of water we're looking at.
There is. It's pushed right in now and started to flood up onto some of the salt marsh. But it provides a fantastic roost site for all the birds coming in.
And what kind of birds can we see today?
Largely, we have not bar-tailed godwit, dunlin. There will be quite a few ringed plover scattered in amongst. Shell duck, brent geese. There will be gulls out here. They're quite often birds of prey around. They like to chase around after whatever they can find. There will also be things like skylarks in amongst the salt marsh. They feed on the salt marsh in winter. It provides plenty of seeds for them.
Oh, Jeff, look at what we're seeing now. That's incredible,
oh,
isn't
my gosh,
it?
Yes. So this is the sort of murmuration of waders that we get. Just look at that. Isn't that phenomenal? The waders out there, these are mainly bar-tailed godwit and not. They've been out feeding on Maplin Sands during the day, and on high tide they come in here to roost, and every now and then they'll get up and you get these marvellous murmurations just swirling about, much the same as the starlings do.
I was just going to say, they're just like a murmuration of starlings, aren't they? They look so fluid. And oh, look at that, so many
almost,
of them.
You can just hear the wings going over. How perfect is that?
They came right over us, Jeff.
Just phenomenal, isn't it?
And now we're seeing them right out on the other side.
This is the magic of the place. Absolutely phenomenal. And there's so few places you can get this.
And the birds are rising up into the air as the water comes in, so there's less land for them. Is that the idea?
They will push in and they'll congregate somewhere where they're safe, over high water, because there's nowhere for them to feed. So as the mudflats get covered, they will come in here onto the salt marsh areas and roost. Then they will get disturbed occasionally, sometimes by this little bird I'm just going to show you, sat out on the island out here. Do you want to have a little look through the telescope? And there is a peregrine falcon.
Oh my goodness, that's incredible. Standing there so still. I'm almost going to say with a predatory glint in its eye, but I think I'm making that up.
Well, she spends a lot of time sat on the end of that island. It's a she because she's that much bigger than the male would be. And when you see all those waders, you know why she's here. That's food. And probably most mornings she goes out to feed, and then she spends a lot of time digesting.
And they are, I mean, peregrine falcons, I think I read, are they the fastest animal on Earth?
They are in full stoop, really extreme speeds.
And I guess before you created the wetlands, there wouldn't have been these flocks of birds here, and so the peregrine falcon wouldn't have been able to be here either.
Absolutely not. Back when this, before the reserve was built, this was just an open area of effectively agri-desert, I would think of it as. There was very, very little here at all. Very, very few birds. Occasionally we'd have flocks of Brent geese feeding on winter wheat, but other than that, almost nothing.
You remember when it was like that?
I remember it very well like that. I used to do some survey work for the British Trust for Ornithology, winter farmland surveys and skylark breeding surveys out here, and I have to say most of my returns were negative.
Well, there wasn't anything here?
There wasn't anything here.
And in comparison with now, we've heard some beautiful skylarks already this morning.
Absolutely. How it is now, it's just unimaginable. I mean, just beyond anything you could have expected from what was a flat set of fields.
Yeah.
So give you some context maybe for what's happened here. We're doing wetland bird survey, and across the island now there were 29,000 wildfowl and waders here. Across this winter it's been nearly 50,000. If I take peak numbers of each species across the winter, 50,000 birds that weren't here before.
So how many would there have been before?
Maybe 100.
God,
I mean, just it was just crazy. And there would have been no wetland birds here, because none of this existed.
And that's so important, isn't it? Particularly for migrating birds.
All of these,
internationally.
Yes, absolutely. All of these birds have a home now. As long as Maplin Sand sits out there as a feeding ground, which is part of that East Atlantic Highway and very, very important. And this is here as a safe place to roost. And for a lot of birds, they also feed in here to some extent. And you can actually hear the Brent geese because they like the salt marsh edge as well.
And for people who don't completely understand what salt marsh is, what kind of habitat is it?
So it's an area that gets flooded occasionally. So depending on how, whether it's low, medium or high level salt marsh, the extent to which it gets flooded and how frequently it gets flooded in a tidal regime. And there are specialist salt tolerant plants that form communities on here, and those will change as you get into the different levels of salinity.
What kind of plants?
Salicornia, which is quite common in lots of areas out here, which is often used for culinary purposes. It's what people put on their salads sometimes. Sea purslanes here, sea aster is another one that's very common around the area. So as we get later into the year, in autumn, it may not be New England, but we have stunning autumn colours here as the salt marsh turns gold.
On the salt marsh as a kind of habitat, how common is it in the United Kingdom?
It's very much reduced from what it was. One of the major problems is where you have hard sea defences and rising sea levels, that salt marsh gets eroded, and so it slowly disappears around Essex. The amount of salt marsh left now is severely reduced. So creating new area like this that will last, it's effectively climate proofing. It'll last here for a long, long time as the water level dries. Is just fantastic. It has its own communities of insects. It has its own communities of beetles of all sorts. There are sea aster mining bees that we have several colonies on the island. It's got so much going for it as a discrete habitat and a beautiful habitat that has been under pressure everywhere. So creating new areas like this is fantastic. So far, I've recorded 194 species on Wallasey.
This coastline is very important, isn't it, internationally for migrating birds?
Absolutely. The whole of the east coast of the UK takes birds coming from a whole series of original destinations in the Arctic. They come here to winter, they migrate through, their feeding stops, their roosting sites, and birds from here go on down right through France, through Spain, right through South Africa. So we are on a major route for international populations of birds. They're not just ours. You know, this really is an international pit stop, critical to their long-term survival. And as climate change happens, they will need to adjust. And areas like this are absolutely critical to enable them to do that. They will move up and down the coast as needed, and hopefully we will see lots more sites like this over time.
Sheltering from the wind but with an incredible view is one of the visitors here, Andrew Harris, and I've interrupted you having your sandwiches and your cup of coffee, but tell me, why do you like coming to Wallasey Island?
Well, birds is an attraction, and it's wild, I suppose. In Essex, there's not a lot of wild space, and this is one of the few places you can really experience it, I think.
It does feel a world away from somewhere like Southend that we can see in the far distance.
Yeah, Southend, or just across the... Burnham's just across the water as well, so it's close, but it's distant as well.
And on a day like today, you can just see the sun glinting on the water, can't you, and that big expanse of blue sky. It's a feeling of peace here,
yeah,
isn't
it? It's lovely. Yeah, really nice.
I'm walking along the top of one of the seawalls, which gives you a beautiful view, and you can really see the differences in height between one side and the other, which is much lower. I'm going to find out why in just a moment. It's really hard to imagine the scale of this project. It's the biggest of its kind that the RSPB has ever done, and this has completely changed the way this land looks. So I want to hear more about it now from Jeff Kew, who is in charge of the project. And just describe to me where we are now, Jeff.
Well, we're sitting at the far end of Wallasey Island in one of our wind shelters, which is very useful today, looking out over the Roach estuary.
And what we're looking at now really explains why the work needed to be done, because with rising sea levels, there was quite a strong chance that the seawall wouldn't hold.
Yeah, there's two parts to this story. One was the RSPB and our concern and recognition that sea level rise and climate change are real, and seeking to find a place where we could demonstrate how coastal habitats could be recreated and help with the adaptation in the face of sea level rise and climate change.
So the RSPB decided to buy the land, and then this is where the real innovation came in, because you got the earth to create the mud flats, the salt marshes, so important from birds, from an engineering project in the centre of London.
Yes, we thought of ways that we could reduce the amount of water coming onto Wallasey Island, and there's two ways. One is potentially quite expensive tide gates, or seeking to raise the land level. And it was at this time that Crossrail, working with Thames Water, were looking for places where they could beneficially reuse their excavated material. And Crossrail were planning to create what is now the Elizabeth Line. And they essentially chartered a small fleet of ships who were running, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, bringing material to Wallasey Island.
So they must have been absolutely delighted with these millions of tons of earth that they found a place for it, that and it was actually putting it to good use.
Yes, and then the clay was loaded onto dumper trucks and then driven out and placed in the locations where it was needed on site.
And once it got here and was laid out, you wanted to try and create a landscape with this clay, didn't you, that would be good for birds?
Yeah, absolutely. But what you need is deciding where you're going to have salt marsh, so the slightly higher areas, where you're going to keep low areas, which will become tidal mud flats, where you want pools, and where you're going to build your seawalls. And it's brilliant to think that this area at Wallasey Island could be included now in a World Heritage Site. We were very pleased 3 years ago where the UK government decided to put the complex of 21 very important wetlands between the Humber and the Thames onto the UNESCO tentative list.
Well, I'm about to head off from Wallasey Island now, but I'm back with Jeff Delve outside one of the hides. And why is this one of your favourite places on Wallasey Island?
Just the totally different habitat, lovely place to shelter. There's not many. And 360 degree view, loads and loads and loads of beautiful ducks, pintail, shell duck, shoveler, mix of waders in here as well, lots and lots of variety. And it's just an unusual habitat. So shallow saline lagoons, if we get good birds here, they're often on this patch. So we've had a number of different things here, but spoonbills is one of the ones that really love it here. So fantastic to see.
What do you think the people who you show round the island, what do they get out of it, do you think? What do you say to them?
So I've always said I think people need to come with a very open mind, but I always just say to the groups that I took round, if you come, it's all about open eyes, taking what you're looking at, open ears, because people just don't listen enough, and the soundscape here is fantastic, and open hearts. Just take in this magnificent area, this magnificent spectacle.
Open Country was presented by Martha Carney, and the producer in Bristol was Beth O'Dea. All week, Farming Today has been taking a step back in time to look at some of the pivotal moments in farming history. Victorian innovation and technology led to big agricultural and social changes. As populations grew rapidly, farmers in the 19th century strove to advance the way they grew crops, bred more profitable animals, and took advantage of new inventions. In a minute, we'll be taking a look at some of this history in Farming Today this week. That's after this.
If you need help on this, Monday. You're not alone. In the Martin Lewis podcast, I'll give you tips to keep more cash in your pocket and answer your important questions.
Now that we're starting from scratch, what's the best way for us to move forward?
To help your everyday finances just add up. Let's see what we can do. The Martin Lewis podcast. Listen on BBC Sounds.
We'll join the Today programme at 7 o'clock here on Radio 4, but first it's time for Farming Today This Week with Charlotte Smith.
Good morning. This week we get the latest on plans to ban trail hunting as the government launches a consultation.
This is about people who are determined to keep hunting foxes, hares, deer, and will not comply with the law, exploiting every loophole, creating smoke screens. That's why we need the law to be tightened up.
There will be a way forward. We will find a way forward. The sadness is that that has to be in opposition to a government which seems absolutely determined to allow a continuing culture war in the countryside.
We hear from the farming communities that aren't so wild about wildfowl.
They trample crops. The geese defecate all over grass that cause the sheep to become very ill. Every interaction with the geese population causes damage to the crofters.
And cheering us up all this week, the singing farmers who got the golden buzzer.
I always try and belt out a few tunes every day if I'm feeling a bit sad. So throw those curtains wide. One day like this a year would see me right.
Wow. More on that later. We're going to start, though, by looking back. Every week on Farming Today, which you can, of course, hear on weekday mornings at 5:45 here on Radio 4, we have a theme. Next week, it's sheep. But this week, it was a bit different, as we focused on some of the pivotal moments in farming history, which made for some fascinating listening. For instance, the Victorians. As populations grew rapidly, farmers in the 19th century strove to advance the way they grew crops, to breed more profitable animals and take advantage of new inventions, as Bob Huckenhull reports.
A coming together of horses and machinery would revolutionise farming in the Victorian era. At Acton Scott Heritage Museum in Shropshire, Edward, a magnificent shire horse, supervised by the farm manager, Alaric Bowler.
So what Edward's doing now is he's going round basically in a circle. He's attached to the horse gin, which then turns a bigger wheel, powers a belt, then goes to the kibbler, which is for crushing corn and to make corn, like the wheat and everything, more digestible for things like poultry. Prior to horsepower, it would have been children in the morning doing it before they go to school.
Edward the Shire horse belongs to Steve Ledsham, who started a project at Acton Scott to grow crops.
So, Steve, we've walked Edward to the edge of some land, and you're farming it in the same way as the Victorians would have done.
They primarily used a Norfolk four-course crop rotation. You've got to keep the land in good heart, so you've got to make sure it's fertilised, and you've got to make sure the weeds are kept clean. So that enabled you to grow two exhaustive crops and two regenerative crops. So basically you started off with winter wheat. In the spring you sow a spring crop, and then in between those two corn crops you've got a root crop. And if you put the root crop is a cleaning crop, really, because you can clean the land while the roots are growing. You keep the weeds down, and then you also put the muck in the ridges that you sow in the roots. And then the spring-sown oat is undersown with a clover and a ryegrass mixture, and the clover puts the nitrogen back in the soil. Kept the land in a better, in my opinion, it kept the land in a far better condition than the land is today.
Livestock also underwent dramatic changes during the 1800s.
What we've got here is our Gloucestershire Old Spot pigs. These are sort of typical of the breed that they would have had in the Victorian era. So the Victorian era, they saw massive advances in livestock breeding to maximise characteristics for productivity. I mean, added to that as well would have been better nutrition, which then further led to agricultural shows so you could showcase these animals and hike your prices up for purebred ones that have won prizes.
When Queen Victoria came to the throne, the Corn Laws were in place. They kept grain prices high and prevented cheap imports. But the laws were repealed in 1846, paving the way for more competition from abroad. Farm manager Alaric Bowler again.
Technological advances in the way of steam power to boats and trains, as well as advances in agricultural machinery, saw a drop in British corn prices due to vast quantities being able to be harvested and shipped from places like North America at low prices. Constant reductions in the need for workforces on top of cheaper importation led to less and less labour needed in rural locations.
Bob Huckenhull reporting there. Now, most people love to see and hear a skein of geese flying overhead, but in Scotland it can make farmers and crofters more than a little uncomfortable, knowing that their grass or barley could become the bird's dinner. It seems climate change and other developments are presenting some knotty problems, and Scottish farmers want more government action over goose management. How big is this problem and what are the answers? Richard Baines has been finding out.
I'm taking the short ferry ride to the island of Lyng, off the Argyll coast, south of Oban. Warmer weather brought by climate change is allowing more geese of all species to survive and thrive. But there are other factors.
Better quality grass swards being created.
I'm travelling with Alistair McGugan, goose expert with the Government Wildlife Agency Nature Scot.
For example, on Isla, putting more fertiliser out onto the fields, that's then creating better conditions for geese such as Greenland barnacles to overwinter in better condition and go back to their breeding grounds in Greenland in better condition.
So what problems do geese cause? Here on Lyng, Archie Cadzo is doing battle with the birds on the family's beef and sheep farm.
20 years ago, we probably didn't see an awful lot here of any geese, maybe a few migratory ones. But now we see resident Canada and greylag geese, and then we see barnacle geese coming down to overwinter. And they come in much larger numbers, big 500-strong groups. The way they do graze is that they pull the whole root out of the ground, and that plant can't regenerate.
What can you do about it?
Scare them away. Barnacle are protected. We are encouraged to shoot Canadas, and you can set up these systems, your classic crow scarer, but they get quite used to that. So now our options are drive at them with a quad bike and try and push them off.
They trample crops, in particular the beer barley crop, which is kind of a shorter height plant, and the geese consume it in vast quantities.
John Gillies is from Storus Uist, the community owner of the South Uist crofting estate in the Outer Hebrides. There are around 9,000 greylag geese there.
The geese defecate all over grass which the sheep and cattle eat. cause the sheep to become very ill. Every interaction with the geese population causes damage to the crofters.
There is some Nature Scot money in the Western Isles for goose problems, but John Gillies says it's not enough.
If a goose is laying, you know, between 6 and 8 eggs, and half of those eggs are turning into chicks that are surviving, and half the geese population is female, they're never going to kill enough geese to actually reduce the size of the flock.
We're not getting such hard winters as we were previously. So some of our migratory geese, particularly greylags, coming in from Iceland and other species coming in from Greenland, they're not going as far south, so they're staying up in, say, Caithness and Orkney. And that's then multiplying the problem for the farmers in Orkney who are already dealing with about 24,000 greylag that are breeding there all the year round.
One of the solutions on Orkney has been to permit the sale of goose meat to encourage shooting. But each location and each species requires a different set of solutions.
Let's take barnacle geese on Islay, the Greenland barnacle geese. There we do have a management scheme. The farmers are reseeding a ground that's protected, or on another area where it's a feeding area, so therefore you're not allowed to scare them on those fields. So they're able to use different fields for different purposes, and there is a payment there for that. But there is also lethal control going on, lethal scaring going on.
The National Farmers Union Scotland has called for urgent action over geese from the government. Scottish Agriculture Minister Jim Fairley says the government spends £1 million a year on goose mitigation and is working with stakeholders on new ways forward after a policy review. And it's just announced an extra £20,000 to cut goose numbers in the Uists and the neighbouring island of Barra.
Richard Baines reporting there. Seafood processors are getting ready for new rules which will affect the way they deal with shellfish. Crustaceans like lobsters, crabs and prawns are now recognised as sentient beings which can feel pain. Under the government's animal welfare strategy, announced at the end of last year, they must be dispatched as painlessly as possible before they're cooked. Well, Anna Hill joined Paul Harding from the Colchester Oyster Fishery at a workshop on Mersey Island in Essex to find out what that means for the industry and how they're using new technologies to process other types of shellfish, bivalves like mussels, clams and oysters.
If we start outside, there are two washing machines. We're very muddy here, so they need washing twice. They just get emptied into blue trays for depuration.
UV light.
UV light sterilises the water and that circulates through the oysters for a minimum of 42 hours.
But Paul Harding has taken cleaning up the oysters to another level. The bivalves are taken to a pressure machine, which is usually used by fruit juice companies to remove viruses. It's the first time any shellfish processor has used this method.
We put the oysters in water, and that goes through a machine which takes it to 6,000 bar of pressure. 6,000 bar is 6 times the pressure at the deepest part of the ocean. What that does, it kills anything within the oyster. It kills the oyster, but kills anything within the oyster. But it's guaranteed safe and it's ready to go.
Things are changing for crustacea processing too. New rules are being brought in to ensure all crustacea are killed humanely before cooking. David Jarrett, Chief Executive of the Shellfish Association of Great Britain, organised the workshop.
Conscious boiling is now deemed to be not appropriate.
Now, conscious boiling means putting a live animal into boiling water.
That's correct. And some people have been doing that for many, many years. And a lot of places around the world still do that. But under the welfare of animals at the time of killing legislation, that will be deemed inappropriate. So large crustacea, crabs, lobsters, langoustine will have to be killed before cooking. And that is where it's going to have a huge impact on the hospitality sector. The question is, will they turn around and not want to do the killing via electronic stunning or the killing with mechanical means, that is spiking of crabs or splitting of lobsters? Because if they won't, they'll end up buying frozen, which means they'll be buying imported produce.
Has that met the same animal welfare standards as the UK?
No, short answer, they won't have been. The lobsters particularly will be Canadian, and at the moment there are only 2 or 3 countries worldwide that recognise crustacea as being sentient.
And Canada isn't one of them.
And Canada's not one of them. Our concern is the impact on the hospitality sector and the damage that could do to our supply chains in the UK.
For chefs, it means bringing in new equipment to stun lobsters, crabs and langoustines, or splitting lobsters in half before they're cooked. Private chef Mark Lloyd agrees animal welfare is paramount, but the new rules will add cost.
All chefs don't want any animal suffering before we kill it in any form, or cook it or eat it. We want to do it in the most effective, safest way possible. This process is going to add possibly a lot more paperwork. It's going to be more expensive for the kitchens. I'm concerned that we will resort to cheaper imported prepared ingredients rather than our own British ingredients at a time when our producers need to be supported the most.
Mark Lloyd there. Well, he was talking about prices there, and war in the Middle East continues to disrupt supplies of fuel and fertiliser around the world. The National Farmers Union here has warned that inflationary pressures from the conflict could soon be seen in food prices. And there are concerns about CO2 shortages. CO2 is a byproduct of fertiliser manufacturing, and it's used for stunning pigs in abattoirs, packaging salads and making fizzy drinks. A bioethanol plant in Teesside, which was the UK's only remaining manufacturer of CO2 gas, closed last year because after a trade deal saw tariffs removed on imports of American bioethanol, it couldn't compete. However, the Ensis site in Redcar is to start production again with £100 million from the government. Chris McDonald is the Minister for Industry.
One of the consequences of the conflict in the Middle East has been a constraint of supply for a number of chemical products. And there's an increase in fuel prices, which has impacted on the production of carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide's vital for our economy in a number of different ways. And the Ensis plant as a whole is a very important part of the Wilton Chemicals Cluster as well. So actually bringing this plant back online, I'm really pleased that we've managed to do that because it also makes the Wilton Chemicals Cluster more financially sustainable.
Shortages of fertiliser are being felt by UK farmers. Robin Aird manages Charlton Park Farm near Malmesbury in Wiltshire.
We paid about £350 a tonne for our fertiliser. If I wanted to go and buy fertiliser today, we'd be looking around £600 a tonne, but the biggest issue is availability. So if you're a 100-hectare farm, so 250-acre, and you were looking to go and purchase fertiliser today, you'd be having to find around £14,000 extra on top of your standard fertiliser cost.
Well, who better to talk about all of this than the Agricultural Economics Society, which held its annual conference in Oxford this week. Paul Wilson, the outgoing president, spoke to Anna Hill.
The food system that we operate in the UK is increasingly globalised, so anything that disrupts trade will very quickly lead through to potential disruptions in terms of food for consumers. The only people who may benefit in this kind of scenario are those that are holding stocks of oil or holding stocks of things that can't get through the Strait of Hormuz at the moment, and then the prices are pushed up and those people will benefit.
There is an argument, I suppose, for building much more resilience by each country having better domestic food security.
Yes, I mean, there is a food security argument that would suggest that people need to focus much more on food security in their own countries. There is an economic argument that says, well, the countries that are able to produce the food at the lowest price or the lowest environmental footprint, those countries should produce that commodity, and then other countries where they can specialise in another commodity should produce those, and then trade should happen, and that should make us all better off. But of course, whilst trade does generally make everyone better off, it does mean that we do need the trade to flow around the world, and that's a little bit of a challenge when we have these disruptions.
There has been concern about price rises in the shops for food and even possibly empty shelves.
I think it will differ depending on the product. So there could well be empty shelves in supermarkets, but I don't think that we're imminently at that point. I mean, if we take the current production year in the UK, for example, a lot of the arable crops are already grown, but they do need this fertiliser to be spread. And if farmers can't get access to the diesel to power the tractors to spread the fertiliser, then we'll have lower yielding crops in the autumn. So there may be a reduction in supply moving forward. So the knock-on impact of this war may not be felt imminently at the supermarket shelves, but down the line those impacts could well be felt unless this is resolved quite quickly and the international trade flows start moving very quickly as well.
Paul Wilson from the Agricultural Economics Society. This week, the government opened a consultation on its plans to ban trail hunting in England and Wales. There is already a ban in Scotland. In trail hunting, hounds follow a pre-laid animal-based scent. It replaced traditional fox hunting after that was banned in England and Wales in 2004. And as we've reported many times since, it is controversial. Anti-hunt campaigners want clean boot hunting, where hounds follow the scent of humans, or drag hunting using a non-animal scent. They say trail hunting is a smokescreen for the illegal hunting of foxes. Country sports enthusiasts say trail hunting takes place within the law, and those who do break the law are prosecuted under existing legislation. The Countryside Alliance is a vociferous campaigner for hunting. Tim Bonner, its chief executive, spoke to Kaz Graham.
It's not a surprise, but just because it's not a surprise doesn't mean it isn't a bizarre priority. You know, even if you look at, simply at the animal welfare strategy, what about all the other issues in there? This apparently is the most important thing. I mean, the consultation itself, there seems to be no real attempt to justify this legislation. You know, we're going to have to go through the whole process in Parliament. We're going to have to battle over that. It was 700 hours the last time a Labour government legislated on hunting. I just find it very, very strange indeed. But the government, which says that it's focused on a cost of living crisis, on delivering growth, and yet here we are having an argument over one of the most irrelevant issues that's possible to consider.
Well, many would consider that it's not irrelevant. Obviously, it's not war in the Middle East, but it's not irrelevant. I mean, the National Police Chiefs Council have said that trail hunting provides a smokescreen.
The fact is that more people are convicted under the Hunting Act than any other piece of wildlife legislation. What is the problem that the government is seeking to address? If you chase a wild mammal with your dogs, you are committing an offence, and there is ample evidence from the government's own statistics that you will be convicted of that offence. So what are we doing here?
They're not going to ban drag hunting, though, are they? Why can't hunts just move to that?
Hunts will have to adhere to whatever legislation is passed and try to find a way to continue to work within the law. I hope that's a transition that most hunts will be able to make, but there's no guarantee to that. And given the importance that hunts have in rural communities, the social hub, the employment, the services they provide to farmers, the farming community, putting all that at risk on the basis of some undefined problem, it's something that we just can't support at all.
Tim Bonner from the Countryside Alliance. The League Against Cruel Sports is a vociferous campaigner against hunting. Emma Slavinsky is their CEO. She welcomes the consultation on banning trail hunting in England and Wales.
We're delighted. We have been asking the government for a long time to get on with this, so it's great that they have. And we're really pleased to see that, as well as talking about the ban on trail hunting, it also is talking about the wider Hunting Act and ways in which that needs to be tightened up to make sure that we are getting rid of the hunting of foxes and deer and hares for good.
You know, the Countryside Alliance argues that the existing Hunting Act, which took years to thrash out, is adequate and it is able to prosecute law-breaking. Haven't they got a point?
No, they don't, I'm afraid. And Chief Superintendent Matt Longman, who leads for the National Police Chiefs Council on this issue, he says the Hunting Act doesn't work. Illegal hunting is prolific and trail hunting is being used as a smokescreen. And just already this season, so from about August last year to now, and the season's not over yet, we've had nearly 600 instances of illegal hunting, and that's just where the hunts are being monitored. You know, no one's trying to stop genuinely simulated hunting, like clean boot hunting with bloodhounds. This is about people who are determined to keep hunting foxes, hares, deer, and will not comply with the law, exploiting every loophole, creating smoke screens. That's why we need the law to be tightened up.
Emma Slavinsky from the League Against Cruel Sports. The government consultation on banning trail hunting in England and Wales closes on June the 18th. Let's round off with something musical and uplifting. It's a farmers' choir. Perhaps we should call them the farmers' choir now, because they have made it to the semi-finals of Britain's Got Talent. BBC Look East's Alex Dunlop has been to meet one of the farmers and singers, Ben Brook.
I always try and belt out a few tunes every day if I'm feeling a bit sad, because, yeah, when you're out here by yourself, it can be quite sad.
In a tractor cab on his 2,500-acre farm near March in Cambridgeshire, Ben Brook cuts a lonely figure as he rolls his fields. He seems more comfortable talking about singing than actually singing.
I don't know if you'd want to hear me sing, to be fair.
Well, with respect, he's wrong, because last weekend, millions tuned into Britain's Got Talent on ITV1 to listen to him and 32 fellow farmers sing Elbow's anthem, One Day Like This. Tears were shed, jaws hit the floor, and the crowd, of course, went wild. The question, would a judge press the so-called golden buzzer and give the Hawkston Choir an instant ticket to the show's live semi-finals? Within seconds, Amanda Holden was on her feet. She had no doubts.
And obviously she pressed the golden buzzer. And I looked round, and all the choir were just like jumping around, and I was just like, we don't even know if we've got through yet. And then looked down, it was all gold, and I was just like, woo!
I mean, that must have been an immense feeling.
Amazing. It's like being in like a family you didn't know you had. It's just amazing. Like, farming can be like super isolating, and you're in your own thoughts a lot. So if we can raise awareness for mental health in agriculture, that's something that we really want to push.
Research by the Farm Safety Foundation suggests that 95% of young farmers believe that poor mental health is the biggest hidden problem facing the industry. Now, joining a choir, of course, isn't a cure, but it can be an antidote to issues like isolation, encouraging farmers to sing together and to talk to each other.
And it seems singing really does lift the soul. Stephanie Barclay, who runs the Farm Safety Foundation charity, says farmers' choirs are starting up all across the UK.
It's a sense of community. These are people that work 17 hours a day on their own with nobody else to talk to. So finding a community of people that you can get together with, let off a bit of steam and sing your hearts out, well, that's got to be good for your mental health.
The semi-finals of ITV's Britain's Got Talent beckon in May, but Ben says the Hawkston Choir is already a winner.
I mean, that's all it's about for us, is raising awareness in the agriculture industry, just bringing everyone back together. I mean, we're British at the end of the day, we're on Britain's Got Talent, so yeah.
Standing in Ben's grain store, which has near perfect acoustics, I twist his arm for a mini rendition of that winning song.
You've got a new talent, and it'd be remiss of me not to ask you just to give us a few lines.
From the song, you want me to sing from the song?
Yeah,
the song,
just a couple of lines.
So throw those curtains wide. One day like this a year would see me right.
What a voice. Good luck.
Cheers.
Oh, that's got me weepy all over again. Alex Dunlop there talking to farmer and singer Ben Brooke. And that's it from us. I'm Charlotte Smith. The producer is Rebecca Rooney. And Farming Today this week is a BBC Audio Bristol production.
There'll be more farming news on Monday at 5:45. Later on this morning, we'll hear the story of what was arguably the greatest archaeological discovery of all time, the Terracotta Army. It's so large that much of it still remains to be explored. That's the focus of You're Dead to Me here on Radio 4 this morning at 10. We'll join the Today programme in a couple of minutes, but first with an update on the weather, here's Sarah Keith-Lucas.
Thank you, Alan. Well, the weekend's weather is looking really unsettled. We're going to see four seasons in one day, really. It's going to be windy. There'll be some sunshine, but plenty of heavy showers, some hill snow in the north too. And it really will feel quite chilly with a cold air mass and an added wind chill too. Now today, across Scotland and Northern Ireland, plenty of heavy, frequent showers from the word go. There's some sleet and snow over the highest ground and some hail in the mix too, and it is windy. So that's the way it looks through much of the day. Into the afternoon, the showers become a little less frequent, the winds ease a little bit, and there'll be some drier weather, particularly to the south and east of any high ground in shelter. But temperatures only about 6 to 9 degrees, gusts of wind 50 to 60 miles an hour in the northwest. So a very blustery, showery picture, and there could be 5 to 8 centimetres of snow over the highest ground in parts of Highland. For England and Wales, most places are starting dry with some sunshine, but it's chilly from the word go. There's a few showers around in the north and the west, fairly well scattered. Heading through the day, the cloud will build further and we'll see further showers working their way south in that northwesterly breeze. If you do catch a shower, it could be heavy, some hail in the mix, a bit of hill snow perhaps across the Pennines. But the showers across England and Wales will be fairly well scattered and the breeze will be blowing them very quickly. Top temperatures around about 8 to 11 degrees, but feeling cooler in that wind. Now, overnight tonight, the showers and the winds will ease for most places. So under the clear skies, it's going to be a cold night ahead, particularly for central and eastern areas. Bit of frost around. There'll be more rain working in from the northwest by the end of the night, keeping temperatures up here. But don't forget, the clocks are set to spring forward by an hour overnight, so we enter British summertime into tomorrow. Certainly not feeling very summery, though. Into tomorrow, there's a band of rain initially that will affect Northern Ireland and Scotland, so wet and windy here from the word go. Through the day, cloud and rain and brisk winds will push slowly south, followed by sunshine and blustery showers. Temperatures, though, just 9 to 13 Celsius.
Thank you, Sarah. Now let's take a look ahead to a new series which starts next week.
Hello, Brian. It's Roger here.
Hi, Roger. It's Brian.
These are the voice notes of Brian and Roger.
I've had a word with Paul, and he's willing to accept the bet if you live in a bin for a week instead of me.
A dark comedy about friendship.
Hello, Brian. It's Roger here. Yeah, I'll take some reading with me. I've got a sleeping bag. Yeah.
One of them is nice. One of them isn't.
Hello, Brian. Are you going to come down today? I could really do with some water and some fruit.
Brian and Roger, the cult hit comedy, comes to Radio 4 with 6 exclusive episodes starting Wednesday night at 11. Or hear the best of box set now on BBC Sounds.
On FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker. This is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Saturday, the 28th of March. Good to be with you and have your company. This is Today with Leila Nathu and Emma Barnett.
The headlines this morning. Intense missile strikes are continuing across the Gulf as the war enters its second month, with several US soldiers injured in an Iranian attack on an airbase in Saudi Arabia. And the drug safety regulator is to review the warnings given to patients about some medications that can cause sex and gambling addictions. At 7:30, we'll hear from Jane, whose late husband was one of those affected by impulsive behaviours triggered by his Parkinson's drugs.
It's an extraordinary story, and many of you have been in touch about that particular investigation, which was also from the back of a Radio 4 series as well. Also in today's programme, as the UN warns Lebanon is facing a deepening humanitarian crisis, our correspondent Hugo Bechega is in Beirut, speaking to families displaced by the war.
We just want to run because it's so loud, the sound, yeah.
And dangerous.
Very dangerous.
We'll also be joined by the Line of Duty and BAFTA-winning actor Vicky McClure. She is raising the alarm about the levels of opportunity for working-class actors and production staff in the TV industry. And she's got a plan. She'll be live on the programme before 9 o'clock this morning. And with the NASA Artemis 2 mission preparing to launch this week, 4 astronauts will soon travel further from Earth than anyone has ever before.
NASA is ready. This vehicle is definitely ready to go. We went through the flight readiness review. We are ready to launch, but we're also humans trying to load millions of pounds of propellant onto a giant machine and send it to the moon.
Rather you than me. But incredible stuff. We will be asking how the astronauts will be preparing mentally and what psychological impact their journey around the moon could have.
Good morning. I'm Jonathan Ledyard with your Saturday Sport. Tiger Woods has been released from jail in the last hour after being arrested for driving under the influence near his home in Florida. He was involved in a car crash, but there were no injuries. We'll consider what this latest incident means for his career. Meanwhile, England's World Cup hopefuls struggled to convince Thomas Tuchel they can be World Cup winners in the summer. Full analysis of last night's 1-1 draw with Uruguay in the next half hour.
For that, the BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
Exactly a month after the start of the Iran war, President Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff has said he's hopeful talks will take place with Tehran in the coming days, and that Washington expects an answer to its proposed 15-point peace proposal. Missile strikes have continued across the Gulf. At least 12 American soldiers are reported to have been wounded in an Iranian strike on a military base in Saudi Arabia. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, James Waterhouse, is monitoring developments.
The BBC's US partner, CBS, has been told that some US soldiers were seriously hurt after the Iranian attack on the Prince Sultan Air Base in Saudi Arabia, which also damaged several refueling aircraft. This mostly aerial war is continuing to be fought in many directions, with Gulf nations again intercepting Iranian-launched missiles and drones overnight. Israel's military has reported a first missile strike from Yemen since the war started, with Iran's Houthi allies threatening to join the fighting. Earlier, Iran claimed two plants, which produce nuclear material, were hit by Israeli airstrikes. Officials there said there was no risk to the public. Donald Trump has again insisted that Iran must open up the Strait of Hormuz, a vital shipping lane, in order to make a peace deal. But it seems the Iranians are intent on continuing to assert their control of the waterway.
The drug safety regulator, the MHRA, says it will review the warnings given to patients who are prescribed some common medications which can cause impulsive behaviours. Investigations by the BBC have revealed that some people who were taking drugs for Parkinson's, restless leg syndrome and other conditions developed sex and gambling addictions. The MHRA is looking into the patient leaflets included with eight different drugs, as our investigations correspondent Noel Titheridge reports.
More than 350 people have contacted the BBC in the past year about the impulsive behaviours caused by dopamine agonist drugs and their consequences. Most say they weren't properly warned by doctors about these possible side effects and made no connection between changes in their behaviour and the medication. One solicitor whose impulsive behaviour has been blamed on a drug for Parkinson's disease stole £600,000 to pay for sex and antiques. He later took his own life. Now the BBC has discovered an error in patient leaflets for the drug pramipexol, which wrongly describes impulsive behaviours as uncommon for Parkinson's treatment. Pramipexol's manufacturer, Boehringer Ingelheim, says the MHRA approved its leaflets and they reflect the latest scientific knowledge. The regulator says it will correct the error and review warnings for all of these medications.
The golfer Tiger Woods has been released on bail after he was charged with driving under the influence following a car crash in Florida. The police say the 15-times major champion rolled his SUV while trying to overtake another vehicle. No one was injured. Here's our North America correspondent Peter Bowes.
Tiger Woods was driving near his home on Jupiter Island when the police say he swerved to avoid a collision. Officers at the scene said he showed signs of impairment, but that alcohol was not suspected. Instead, they pointed to the possible influence of medication. Tiger Woods was arrested and taken to jail, where he passed a breath test but refused to provide a urine sample. He was charged with driving under the influence, property damage, and refusal to submit to a lawful test. It's at least the fourth time he's been involved in a car crash. In 2021, he suffered serious leg and ankle injuries in Los Angeles. After years of rehabilitation, the golfer had hoped to return for next month's Masters tournament at Augusta, but that now looks increasingly unlikely.
There's a warning that some pregnant women and cancer patients are facing life-threatening delays to ultrasound scans because of a shortage of staff to carry them out. The latest UK census of sonographers has found that vacancy rates have risen sharply in the past 6 years. Here's our health reporter, Philippa Roxby.
Ultrasound is used to see images of everything from a baby in the womb to muscles and organs, while also helping to diagnose cancers. The Society of Radiographers, which represents sonographers, says demand for ultrasound in healthcare has increased, but there aren't enough people being trained to do the job. In England, where there are just over 1,800 sonographers, one in four posts are currently unfilled. In the southeast of England, 38% of posts are vacant. In the northwest, it's 30%. The government said it was taking action to ensure the NHS had the skilled staff it needed, while rolling out new community diagnostic centres to keep patients away from busy hospitals.
Emails uncovered in the Epstein files reveal a US-based model agent introduced women as young as 18 to the convicted sex offender and pleaded with him to have sex with a model he knew. Ramzi El-Khoury sent Jeffrey Epstein hundreds of emails over almost a decade discussing women, their bodies and their attitudes to sex, often in vulgar terms. Our business correspondent Ben King has been looking through the documents released by the US Department of Justice.
Ramzi El-Khoury apparently wrote to Jeffrey Epstein in 2009 saying he valued his friendship shortly after the American was released from prison for soliciting prostitution. Emails between the pair over the next decade suggest Mr. El-Khoury introduced the financier to a number of young women. One was an 18-year-old Russian student he met in a shop. Mr. El-Khoury says it was to help her find modelling opportunities. In another graphic email chain from 2011, he described a model who was desperate for cash and wrote, "Dear Jeffrey, please just try her in bed." Mr. El-Kholy told the BBC he regretted the language he'd used in some emails and his association with Epstein, and he had not been aware the financier had been abusing women.
Research suggests the distinctive red paintwork on one of Wales's most popular castles may not always have been the bright colour it is now. Experts undertaking conservation work at Castell Coch, just outside Cardiff, have carried out detailed scientific analysis of paint samples and learned that the current red is a more recent addition, as our Wales correspondent Thomas Morgan reports.
Originally built as a hunting lodge in the 13th century, Castell Coch was rebuilt in the 1800s by the 3rd Marquis of Bute. Since then, it's become known for its distinctive red paintwork on everything including windows, doors and shutters. But new research has revealed that there have been no fewer than 16 different phases of redecoration. Conservators now believe the original Victorian paint finish, an orange shade of red, was quite different from the darker colour that's evolved over time. They've used traces to create a new paint, named the rather dry Castell Coch Red 2025, which will be used for any more redecoration.
Mary Rand, one of the first British women to win an Olympic gold medal in the athletics, died at the age of 86. She won 3 medals at the Tokyo Games in 1964, bronze in the 4x100 metre relay, silver in the pentathlon and gold in the long jump, where she set a new world record. Her friend, an Olympic gold medalist, Anne Packer, described her as the most gifted athlete she'd ever seen. In an interview with the BBC before the 2012 London Olympics, Mary Rand said she'd always been ambitious.
I've always said, when people have said, what is the one thing you would really like to have? You know, is it a gold medal? And I said, I would really like to have a world record. Even if it's for 5 minutes, you're best in the world at something. And I said, it would be great to have that and a gold medal. And I never dreamt in a million years that would happen.
Mary Rand, the first British woman to win an Olympic gold medal in athletics, who has died.
Alan, thank you. It's 7:10. Let us start with a quick look at today's papers. Both the Daily Mail and the I Weekend lead with the impact of the war in the Middle East on the UK. The I is running a poll that it has commissioned saying that it's found 50% of voters are tightening their belts in response to the war, with people spending less on eating out, on fuel, on big purchases and on energy. The Mail, for their part, picks up on the impact on petrol prices, topping £1.50 a litre. We will be discussing that a little bit later on this hour. It goes on the Mail. Comments by Asda's chairman, Alan Layton, saying that ministers had zero credibility when it comes to their warnings about retailers ripping off customers. And a quick look at the Daily Telegraph, which has for its lead a separate story about Scotland Yard, it says, reopening its investigation into the reported theft off the phone of Morgan McSweeney. That's the Prime Minister's former chief of staff. This is amid questions about the communication between Morgan McSweeney and Peter Mandelson ahead of his appointment as US ambassador. So Scotland Yard, according to the Telegraph, are examining CCTV footage from Westminster where Morgan McSweeney claims that he was robbed in October last year.
Just turning our attention to the Times, a couple of pieces in here I thought I'd flag to you this morning. The Times journalist Kate McCann has spoken about the abuse she's received after interviewing an Iran apologist. He's described as the chief propagandist for the Iranian regime. And it's pretty graphic what she's received. She's talked about a whole slew of abuse, including rape threats, pedo protector, she's been called, a Zionist shill, a white supremacist apologist. She's been, as she puts it, accused of being a Jew. She isn't a Jew. I could go on, but it doesn't really make for great breakfast listening, or I'm sure for Kate McCann or any journalist receiving such abuse at all an okay experience, to say the least. But she's had hundreds of comments and direct messages and posts after that particular interview that she's flagging. So facing rape threats for trying to talk to somebody who speaks on behalf of the Iranian regime. I think it's worth bringing up this morning, as is something else around time. Of course, a big part of Radio 4, the pips and the sound of Big Ben. Big Ben has got a smidgen ahead of itself, apparently. The hammer, as the hammer struck nine, Andrew Strangeway, who's part of the time team there, looked at what the time should be, and it was 8:59 and 98, or 59 and 98 seconds, he said. We can live with that. They're always looking to see that it's on time. And it was built in the 1850s, but the clockmakers of Westminster are winding down the clock for its spring reset. And from 6 o'clock today, this is what's reported in the paper I wanted to share with you, when the clock is stopped for repairs and to align with daylight savings, the four dials on the Elizabeth Tower will show the wrong time until 2 o'clock in the morning. Speaking of which, it's 13 minutes past seven, which I think is accurate to say at this stage. Let's bring our attention back to the Middle East. And Israel's military has detected a first missile launch from Yemen. That's since the Middle East war began a whole month ago. There were no reports of any casualties or damage in Israel yet, but this could be a significant escalation by Iran. James Waterhouse, our correspondent, is in Jerusalem to help us out with this a bit more. Remind us about the role of Yemen, the potential role of Yemen here, and also who are the Houthis?
Morning, Emma. Yeah, I mean, this is an extra dimension, an extra complication as far as the US and Israel is concerned. We have reports of a first missile launched by Houthi rebels. A proxy of Iran, an ally of Iran. Typically, they don't cause the Israeli air defences too much of a headache, we understand. But in the past, not least with Israel's war with Hamas in 2023, we saw the Houthis disrupt the Red Sea shipping lane by targeting commercial vessels. It sounds an awful lot like this, what's happening with the Strait of Hormuz. So should that happen, that would pose a decision for the Americans on whether to get involved there, as they have done before. And of course, it would worsen an already difficult, to put it mildly, situation with global trade. But when you consider that Israel's and America's goal is partly, they say, to diminish Iran's ability to supply and support its proxy forces as part of the so-called axis of resistance against Israel, the opposite seems to be happening with this latest development, despite other groups like Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas in Gaza being degraded by the Israelis to quite a large extent.
We'll get into more detail about that shortly and throughout the programme. But James, let me also bring our listeners' attention to what's being reported by our partner CBS, that at least 12, broadcasting partner I should say, 12 American soldiers have been injured after an Iranian strike on a military base in Saudi Arabia. Is that right?
That's right. It's not just CBS. We're seeing it more widely reported in America as well. This is about the Prince Sultan Air Base in Saudi Arabia, reportedly hit by at least one Iranian missile and several drones. Buildings were damaged. I think at least two of those personnel are seriously injured, and several refueling aircraft were damaged as well. There are across Saudi Arabia, across the Gulf, America does have air bases in which it's using them to mount continued aerial bombardments on Iran. And, you know, injuries to US personnel pose difficult political questions for the White House. It increases the accountability it may feel. We've already seen previous deaths. Donald Trump has welcomed their caskets back to America. But, you know, as support domestically for Donald Trump for this invasion continues to wane, this would only add to it. But it's a further symptom of Iran's ability to hit back, yes, not just at Israel directly, which is a partner of America, but also across the Gulf to apply pressure.
James Waterhouse, who's our correspondent there in Jerusalem. Thank you.
Well, let's pick up on what James mentioned there about Yemen's possible involvement in this conflict, because in the last few minutes, the Reuters news agency is reporting that the Houthi armed group has confirmed that they launched that missile towards Israel. They said they're attacking Israel after continued targeting of infrastructure in Iran, Lebanon, Iraq and the Palestinian territories. And just a couple of other lines coming in from Reuters saying that Yemen's Houthis say their operations will continue until their goals are reached. Let us talk this through now with Faria Al-Muslimi, research fellow on the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House. Many thanks for joining us at short notice this morning, Faria.
No worries. Thank you very much for having me.
How significant would you say this is, that the Houthis have now got involved?
It's a huge significance because the Houthis obviously sit on another important international trade route, that's the Red Sea and specifically Bab al-Mandab. And because the Houthis is a group that also have a huge leverage over infrastructure across the Gulf, specifically oil infrastructure, their missile can reach this. So it's going to be another horrible dimension added into this war. And as you mentioned, the Houthis just took a credit 60 seconds ago of the recent strikes they did this morning, or the ballistic missiles. And they mentioned that it was a bunch of them, not just one. So it's a telling about how far the group is willing to go. And obviously, this was not in the radar a few weeks ago. But I think right now we are seeing another front line added into this. They have not yet said they will attack the Red Sea, so that's a difference. And I think they are trying to spare themselves an American attack against them, and so far has kept it only on Israel. But that doesn't mean they will not move on toward that in the next few days, should things go forward.
Why have they held off getting involved so far? Is it because Iran needed another lever to pull if it wanted to escalate things from its point of view?
Yes, but also because the Houthis does not have the same command and control or theological relationship with Iran as Hezbollah. It's also because they were still hopeful for a roadmap that will give them huge financial incentives. But it's also because they still were still suffering, and they are still suffering from the from the military destruction they have had from the American airstrikes last year over them. It really did make them blind and destroyed a good number of their military equipment by that time.
How disruptive would it be to have both a blockade in the Red Sea, an effective blockade in the Red Sea and in the Strait of Hormuz simultaneously?
It's a nightmare. It's already what we have, a nightmare, and this will make it worse of a nightmare. But the Houthis also, even if they don't have the same military capabilities as Hezbollah or as Iran, all they have to do is one rocket to land in Israel, and then that can be bad enough. Also, what happens is the insurance and the international trade route is first and foremost a perception. So if they only are able to have successfully one attack, that's bad enough. It's bad enough for insurance companies, it's bad enough for oil companies, and it's bad enough for everyone. Also, let alone, it's bad for 28 million Yemenis who are already suffering from a huge humanitarian crisis in Yemen.
And where does this leave the prospect of negotiations? Because one of the demands contained in President Trump's 15-point plan that has apparently gone to Iran is for Iran to cease cooperation with its proxies. That has been a long-standing ask of the US in negotiations with Iran, but it doesn't look like that's, well, it looks like the opposite is true.
Absolutely. As you said, the opposite is true. And in fact, it's only increasing this tightening between Iran and its proxies in the region. Iran has invested in the Houthis for almost 30 years. So now has become the time, for the first time, in which the Houthis have to send back that favor. So there is no way that actually it would decrease the tightening of relationship between the two groups. Yes, there are less Revolutionary Guard members in Sana'a since the Iran-Israel war last year, because they have been moving back to Lebanon and Iran. But there is still enough to even shoot rockets at Israel, even if the Houthis decide at one point they do not want that.
Faria al-Muslimi, research fellow on the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House. Many thanks.
It's 22 minutes past seven. Time is running out for the assisted dying bill to become law as the end of the parliamentary session looms. The bill would allow adults in England and Wales to ask for help to die if they're judged to have less than 6 months to live. On day 13 of detailed scrutiny, Piers focused on safeguards for medical professionals who do not want to take part in helping someone to die. Here's our parliamentary correspondent who's put it together for us, Susan Hume.
The bill's sponsors have said their intention is that doctors and others should have to opt in to helping with assisted dying. No one would be pressured to participate. But some peers want that protection to be spelt out in the bill, or as the non-party peer Lady Fox put it,
I think of this group of amendments as the workers' rights group.
Another non-party peer, Lady O'Lone, argued that if people had to opt out of participation or even from training in the subject, their careers could be harmed.
Many of those who work in healthcare
have religious beliefs which would preclude their engagement in facilitating others to kill themselves. Catholics, some other Christians, Muslims would be precluded from participation, yet may be prejudiced in their employment opportunities and prospects by this inability to engage. It is important, therefore, that this factor is considered.
A Lib Dem, Lord Mohammed interrupted. He agreed that people from those faiths tended not to believe in assisted dying.
But people from those faiths also don't believe in childbirth before marriage. But is there any evidence to suggest that people are opting out of midwifery because of that reason? Or is it just your opinion that people from those faiths may not want to take part? Because I'm from one of those faiths, and my more noble lords may have heard that assisted dying might not be for me, but I'm not here to stop others.
Lady Campbell, a non-party peer who needs help to breathe and attends remotely, got her assistant to read some of her speech. She described a recent experience.
Last summer, I spent 6 weeks in St Thomas's critical care after an accident at sea in the Bay of Biscay. I came home broken, bruised and in terrible pain. But my salvation was the compassionate, dedicated team of health professionals whose combined efforts brought me back to life and back to this chamber.
Lady Campbell said she'd asked them all if they'd participate in an assisted death, but not one of them had said they would, and she said that made her feel safer in their care. But Labour's Lord Faulkner, who's steering the bill through the House of Lords, was vehement. There were already strong protections in place for medical workers who did not want to be involved.
The key thing for the doctor to know is there can be no legal duty on him or her ever to raise it or ever to become a participant in the system. Now, I was thinking, what more could... Wait, just let me finish. What more could one do to give protection to doctors?
There are no votes at this stage, and the House of Lords will come back to the assisted dying bill once again after Parliament's Easter recess.
Susan Hume reporting there. It's 25 minutes past seven. Some apprentices at the water company Severn Trent struggle to tell the time because they simply don't know how. That's what an executive at the company has told a House of Lords committee this week. And that admission, as you may imagine, prompted gasps from those in attendance. Neil Morrison is the HR director at Severn Trent, who's been explaining what problems that not having basic math skills in the workplace can create.
If I take our apprenticeship intake, about 20% join without any qualification and 10% are considered to have low numeracy skills, so that of an 11-year-old. And I guess what does that mean in reality? Things like telling the time is problematic, which is a problem in terms of shift patterns and working to shifts. Doing basic calculations, struggling with percentages, deductions of things like payslips, tax, national insurance, and then job-related calculations. So understanding flow, understanding basic measures and calculating duration.
Listening to that, Bobby Siegel, a maths teacher and host of Broken How to Fix It, the podcast, and was also given evidence to that same committee. Good morning, Bobby.
Good morning, Emma.
Come to that committee in just a moment. I mean, I still just need, you know, what is your reaction when you hear apprentices, you know, young adults in Britain not being able to tell the time?
Yeah, again, I am, as a teacher, I've been teaching in secondaries for a decade and primaries for the last couple of years. I am saddened, but unfortunately, I'm not surprised. And I think partly this is a issue of competence and confidence with numeracy, because I always think about the way we set people up with GCSE, Emma, because ultimately GCSE, we have 600,000 children going through the exams, but currently it's norm reference. It means that students are assessed against their peers, so like a bell curve. So we tell one third of children they get a grade 3 or below, which is effectively, it's a GCSE, but it doesn't mean that they can progress up the path ladder. We're telling them that they can't do math. So automatically we have an issue with confidence with young people.
There's confidence, but I suppose normally, I think, you tell me, that you start to learn how to tell the time at around the age of 6 or 7. That had been the norm.
Yes.
So you've gone to where things are at GCSE. What's not happening now at the ages of 6 or 7 in Britain for some people, some children, which means they are not learning how to tell the time?
Yeah, Yeah. Again, I do think our state of education in primary and secondary has improved, but I also think the nature of our qualifications, again, children often sometimes they'll join secondaries having had on the whole a reasonably positive experience of maths. They find maths engaging and fun, but in secondary we seem to batter them with a curriculum that is focused on heavily towards an exam. That's, again, there's things like Pythagoras, trigonometry, circle theorems, which are important parts of maths if you want to progress up towards A levels, etc. But it's the functional skills that we're losing, because with children, every term we keep progressing them up. Oh, a new topic. And we don't establish the foundations for children.
How can we change it? This, you know, this committee has been brought together by a desire for change, right?
Yes, absolutely. Again, I was with Professor Hannah Fry in the committee, and we made two recommendations between the two of us. So one which Professor Fry mentioned, which has been referenced by other maths professionals, is one is why not have a freestanding numeracy qualification that's separate to the GCSE. So the GCSE maths, everyone could be entitled to do, but like the driving license, everyone should get a numeracy qualification so that they can do the basic things like percentages and understanding risk and understanding how to do a spreadsheet, the basic numbers. But the second one I mentioned is this year, Emma, we've got the National Year of Reading, which has been brilliant. Everyone's having conversations about, you know, the tragedy of how reading has been lost as an art form, but we're now trying to get that back on the table. Why not have a National Year of Numeracy where we try and tackle that and actually have conversations like this today?
Tell me just three activities that mean numeracy. I know when you're saying a year of reading, what have I got to go and do? I've got to open a book and I've got to read it. What have I got to do for numeracy? Just briefly.
So numeracy, again, anyone that ever earns income, they've got to look at their payslip and they've got to understand where they're putting their money into a bank account. Another one could be our health. If we're looking at the calorie intake and trying to manage a percentage of fats and sugars, that always needs numbers. And I also say in terms of employment in the workplace, if you're trying to manage a project or you're trying to look at budgets there. So these are things that I feel like as a society, we are letting down our young people and our adults.
More to do. See me, as the teacher used to say.
Yes, absolutely, after school.
God, those words still inspire huge sort of sweat and fear. Bobby Siegel, a maths teacher there, and also someone contributing to this this panel and this House of Lords committee trying to make changes to numeracy. Thank you.
7:30, Jonathan Ledyard has the sports. Morning, Jonathan.
Good morning. Tiger Woods' stellar golf career has hit yet more turbulence. He was released from jail early this morning following his arrest for driving under the influence near his home in Florida. Woods, who's considering a competitive comeback at the US Masters in 10 days' time, rolled his SUV after clipping a truck yesterday afternoon, but there were no significant injuries in the crash. Officers hadn't suspected him of being under the influence of alcohol, but possibly by an unknown substance. Sheriff John Budensek in Martin County made this statement to reporters.
So Mr. Woods did a breathalyzer test, blew triple zeros, but when it came time for us to ask for a urinalysis test, he refused, and so he's been charged with DUI, with property damage, and refusal to submit to a lawful test.
We'll have more on the story in the next 15 minutes and in the sport in the next hour. Here, England's recent running run, a winning run even, under head coach Thomas Tuchel. No goals conceded in six matches, came to a stuttering halt last night. 1-1 draw with Uruguay at Wembley. Tuchel had fielded a completely new team for the first of four friendlies before their opening World Cup match in 81 days' time.
Given the circumstances, we did very well. There were so many new players. It was first time this formation, very feisty and tough opponent. So it was a good test, and I liked the way we played. I liked the way we behaved. It was always positive attitude. Everyone helped each other out. So good team effort.
Accentuating the positive overall, but how many of last night's team improved their chances of being included in that all-important World Cup squad? Let's talk to correspondent John Murray, who was commentating at the match. Morning, John.
Yes, morning from Wembley.
Confusion or clarity over selection then?
Well, in all honesty, largely bar the last 15 minutes or so, it was a bit of a non-event. It was a paper plane night at Wembley. And yes, Thomas Tuchel played more or less his second team, and then he made a maximum of 8 substitutions that were allowed last night. And as we heard, he actually said he learnt a lot, particularly in the detail, he put it. But will that have greatly influenced his World Cup squad selection in May? I'm not sure.
Any notable players, though, on the up, and which players on the slide? Because there's always a bolter who suddenly appears. You think, where's he from?
Well, the two debutants didn't do too much wrong. The two Jameses, Garner in midfield, and the goalkeeper, James Trafford. Marcus Rashford produced a couple of exciting moments. Harry Maguire looked comfortable on his international return, but Thomas Tuchel knew all about them. What was a negative were the injuries to Nonny Madueke of Arsenal and Phil Foden of Manchester City after a couple of heavy challenges. And Phil Foden is one who is not certain of his place in the 26.
What about the Arsenal defender Ben White? A challenging night for him. A goal, a penalty, but underscored by boos from supporters throughout.
Mm. Well, I think this is what this match will be remembered for. And Ben White was making his international return as a substitute. And this is the man who made himself unavailable for England towards the end of Gareth Southgate's time as manager. And yes, some England supporters, a significant minority, I would say, let him know what they thought of him turning his back on England for that time. And they booed him when he came on. And I've never heard this before, booed him after he was announced as the England scorer. His first goal for England. And Ben White was booed at Wembley. Thomas Tuchel said he'll just have to take it on the chin and move on.
John, thank you very much indeed. John will be with us again probably after Tuesday's match against Japan on, obviously, Tuesday night. One other point for you. Britain's George Russell has again been beaten to pole by his 19-year-old Mercedes teammate Kimi Antonelli. He'll start on the front row for tomorrow's Japanese Grand Prix qualifying just completed.
Jonathan, thanks so much. Quick look at the weather at 26 minutes to 8. It will be breezy with sunny spells, variable cloud, scattered showers drifting in from the northwest. They could be locally thundery and falling wintry over the hills in the north.
Where has spring gone, Leila?
I know.
Come on, can you find it?
We all mourn it.
We're at work on a Saturday. The least we could do is tell everyone there's going to be a bit more spring on the 28th of March. But no, you are listening to Today. Thank you for being with us on Radio 4 with Leila Nathu and Emma Barnett. And now we have a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
The US-Israeli war on Iran is entering its second month, with several Gulf nations saying they've intercepted airstrikes overnight. At least 12 American soldiers have reportedly been injured in an Iranian strike on a military base in Saudi Arabia. In a further development, Israel said it had detected a missile from Yemen, the first since the war began. Iran's Houthi allies in Yemen had previously threatened to join the fighting. 8 drugs used to treat conditions like Parkinson's and restless leg syndrome are to have their warnings reviewed by the drugs regulator, the MHRA, after people reported experiencing impulsive behaviours. Some patients told the BBC they developed sex and gambling addictions as a side effect. Tiger Woods, the champion golfer, has been charged with driving under the influence after his car rolled over in a crash near his home in Florida. Police say he was arrested and released on bail. No one was harmed. This latest accident makes his appearance in next month's Masters tournament at Augusta look increasingly unlikely. A census has found that 1 in 4 positions for those qualified to conduct ultrasounds is currently vacant in England. The Society of Radiographers, which represents sonographers, warns this, coupled with a rise in demand, could lead to pregnant women and cancer patients facing life-threatening delays. The government said it was acting to ensure the NHS had the skilled staff it needed. Emails uncovered in the Epstein files reveal a US-based model agent introduced women as young as 18 to the convicted sex offender. Correspondence between the pair suggests Ramzi El-Khoury introduced the financier to a number of young women in the decade after Epstein was released from prison. Mr. El-Khoury said he regretted his association with Epstein and had not been aware the financier had been abusing women. And firefighters are tackling a major blaze at a Grade 2 listed mill building in Staffordshire. The big mill in Leek was unoccupied and had planning permission to be turned into flats. Those living nearby were evacuated and no one is reported to have been injured.
Alan, thank you very much. Now, our next guest's husband became addicted to pornography and demanded sex at least 3 times a day after being prescribed a common drug to treat his Parkinson's. Jane, his wife, was not warned about these side effects by doctors. But when she read about them in the medicine's leaflet, as you know you do, and you check what's going on, she says she was reassured to see them listed, these sorts of side effects, as being uncommon. That's what it said. Now, because of a BBC investigation and a Radio 4 series titled Impulsive, such warnings about the side effects of this family of drugs, also used to treat other conditions such as restless leg syndrome, are to be reviewed. Hundreds of you have been in touch with the BBC with your experiences. And in a moment, I'll talk to the man at the heart of this story, our investigations correspondent. But first, I can speak to Jane, whose husband, I should say, died in 2021. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for, you know, coming to talk to us about something that, you know, must be incredibly painful and a very difficult set of memories. And as I understand it, and you tell us more, that you say that the man you knew before he was prescribed these drugs would have been horrified by his behaviour.
Yes, he would have been horrified. He literally changed overnight into something and someone that I didn't recognise. He was a hardworking man, and he just became a sex addict, I suppose, with very compulsive behaviour, collecting porn snippets and pornography.
And you say overnight. I mean, this must have been a shock for. I mean, he obviously wasn't reacting to his own changes because he's in it, I suppose, at this time. But you're having to try and understand what's going on.
Yes, it was difficult because he couldn't see what the problem was. And I ended up trying to talk to him about it, and it just ended up in arguments. So I then decided to keep a diary of everything that was going on. And when we went to see his consultant, the consultant just told him it was unacceptable behaviour, and that was the end of the matter as far as the consultant was concerned.
What sort of things were you writing in the diary, Jane?
He was not coming to bed until 1:30, 2 in the morning. And when he went to work, I was going through his browsing history, and it was basically pornography. Some of it was professionally done, some of it was home videos, as it were. I don't know whether he had any uploads or downloads on his phone. Wouldn't surprise me. And it was just very upsetting, to be fair.
And you have children who were obviously around, I'm sure, at this time, and a bit older, I believe. But what did they say, or did you try and protect them from this?
No, protected totally. I just acted as a buffer. I didn't want people to know what he was going through and what I was having to go through. And I didn't feel it was fair on him, because I after reading the contraindications, it was obvious that it was classed as an uncommon side effect. So it was down to the drugs rather than him suddenly changing.
And we should say that the drugs actually helped with the Parkinson's, because this is what's also a real bind in this scenario, that
yes,
you can have drugs that help with one symptom and then create a whole other, in this circumstance, which is, you know, it's extreme, a whole other life and personality. And I imagine your last months, years with your husband, who, you know, you greatly love and loved, were overshadowed by this.
Totally. I ended up having to, sounds very callous, but I ended up having to sort of distance myself emotionally from him, because he was, it was a case of self-preservation on my part.
At any point, did you think to take him off the drugs? Not that it was your responsibility, but, you know, the doctor saying, well, this is unacceptable behaviour, doesn't give you then the confidence to say, if the drug's been helping his Parkinson's, well, he should just come off this because he's not the same.
So I'm sorry, could you say that again?
Did you ever think to take him off these drugs yourself? Did you think, come off them now?
No, I didn't. Perhaps I should have done with hindsight, but I'm not a pharmacologist.
No.
he was having a total mix of drugs. He was taking, towards the end, over 12 tablets a day.
I'm not saying you should have done, by the way. I'm just, you know, thinking through how this must have been at the time and the desperation that must have been felt by you and your family. Just let me get your response before I cross to our correspondent. What is your response to the fact that now there is going to be a look at how this particular family of drugs, the warnings around side effects, will be batched? What do you make of that?
I think it's about time. If they knew about these problems, then they should have done something sooner. I can't believe 1 in 6 is an uncommon side effect. And the fact that people are having to go through this blind and suddenly have this handed to them in front of the person that they're trying to help look after and care for, it's scandalous. It's irresponsible.
And took, you know, your last months with your husband in many ways.
Oh, yes. I mean, he died in 21. And it was only literally a few weeks ago that I literally had a flash of a nice memory. I cannot think of a nice memory as I stand here that I had with my husband before Parkinson's. Or even with Parkinson's.
I'm so sorry. Thank you for talking this morning on the radio.
That's all right.
Let me bring in Noel, who's listening, Noel Titheridge, the BBC Investigations correspondent, who's behind this. Noel, you know, you've heard a lot of these stories now, but Jane's is incredibly upsetting. This family of drugs, I say it's used for a range of conditions. This story you've been working on for some time. What's the update this morning? Because you are speaking to a lot of people whose family or themselves directly, their whole personality changed once they got on these drugs and they didn't realise.
Well, exactly. And Jane's experience is typical of a whole theme of the hundreds of people that have got in touch, partners of people that were taking these medications, that spent, as they describe it, nightmarish years seeing unrecognisable behaviour on the part of their partners and dealing with the consequences. But now, in response to our findings, the drug regulator has said it will correct that specific error in one of the drug's leaflets and launch a review of the warnings of all eight of these medications. Now, this will be a substantial review, which will involve seeking advice from independent experts. The regulator, the MHRA, says that no medicine is risk-free and that these drugs have improved many patients' lives. But the chair of the Health Select Committee, Leila Moran, says she wants answers about how this error existed in the leaflets for years.
And just to say, these are called, correct me if I'm wrong, dopamine agonist drugs.
That's right.
Yeah, if people are listening, I mean, you're not going to list all the different names of them, the sort of pharma names, but if people are wondering what sort of drugs we're talking about.
Yeah, so they're used, like you said, for a range of conditions, Parkinson's, restless legs, some tumours and mental health conditions. They work by boosting the activity of dopamine in the brain. That's the chemical that's vital in coordinating movement, so particularly effective with Parkinson's, where sufferers face shakes and tremors and a lack of dopamine.
But there could be people listening to this programme right now, as has happened all the way along your investigation, who are living with someone who has one of these conditions and they've changed. They've become compulsive in behaviour. It's not just sex. It could be, as you say, gambling. It could be all sorts of things.
Exactly. And many of them say that even if they recognised the behaviour, perhaps unlike Jane's husband, the shame of what they were doing meant that they found it immensely difficult to talk about it with their family and with their doctors.
Well, Noel, it's as I say, there's also this the series you can listen to with some of the stories. Impulsive, it's called. You can look it up on Radio 4, on BBC Sounds. But you're continuing with the investigation as well to see where this goes. Noel Titheridge, and also thank you very much to Jane for sharing her family's story.
Quarter to eight now. One of sport's biggest names, Tiger Woods, has been involved in a car crash in Florida. The former golf champion was arrested on charges of driving under the influence. He has since been released on bail. Earlier, I spoke to our North America correspondent, Peter Bowes, who's following the story.
This happened at about 2 PM local time yesterday. Tiger Woods was driving his Range Rover close to his home in Jupiter, Florida, when, according to the police, he swerved to avoid a collision with the vehicle in front of him, a pickup which was towing a trailer, which was turning off the road. The driver of that vehicle reported that the car behind him, Tiger Woods, was approaching at a high speed, then swerved at the last minute, but clipped the back end of his trailer before flipping onto the driver's side. This was Tiger Woods' vehicle. He managed to escape by crawling through the passenger side. He wasn't injured, neither was the other driver. But the police officers at the scene said that Tiger Woods appeared to be impaired, not with alcohol, but likely some form of medication. He was arrested. He was taken to the local jail, where he passed a breath test but refused to give a urine sample. And at that point, he was charged with driving under the influence, with property damage and refusal to submit to a lawful test.
Right. And this isn't the first time that he has been involved in an incident in his car, is it?
It's at least the fourth time that he has been involved in a similar incident. In fact, the last one, 5 years ago in Los Angeles, was much, much more serious. He was lucky to escape alive. He suffered leg and ankle injuries. He needed pins inserted into his foot and his ankle and a rod in his tibia. That accident almost ended his career. In fact, he's had multiple surgeries and lots of rehabilitation since then. 4 years before that, he was again arrested for DUI, driving under the influence. influence. This is again in Jupiter, Florida. Police officers found him slumped at the wheel of his parked car. He was eventually sentenced to a year's probation after pleading guilty to reckless driving.
In terms of his career, I mean, he is obviously still incredibly well-known, incredibly recognisable in the world of sport. And he has been trying to get fit for the Masters in a couple of weeks. This is going to be a huge setback for him professionally, isn't it?
This is, I think it's fair to say, yet another huge setback for him. If you think, once upon a time, he was hailed as one of the first billionaire athletes, much of his wealth coming from endorsements and business deals. And during his heyday, certainly he was one of the most famous people in the world, and he had a reputation for being disciplined and clean-cut, while the truth, well, it eventually came out that he'd had multiple affairs and he was far from the perfect role model that he had once been hailed as. But what was remarkable was that a decade after the height of his initial problems, he came back, 2019, to win the Masters and appeared to redeem himself through the eyes of the public. But the tide does seem to have turned again. He's been struggling, especially since that 2021 accident in Los Angeles, to regain his health. And he had indeed been hoping to be fit enough for the next Masters tournament at Augusta next month. But that comeback, as it would have been, is looking increasingly unlikely.
That was our North America correspondent Peter Bowes talking to me earlier about that car crash involving Tiger Woods.
It's 11 minutes to 8. It's time now for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning, Martin Rowe, writer on culture and spirituality.
Good morning. Before the crack of dawn one day last week, I raced across London to Hackney Marshes on a journey back to the origins of religion. Walking in the gloom towards a hum of distant voices across frosted football pitches, I arrived at a crowd of several hundred people, drinking coffee, doing yoga, singing, but mostly looking up to the sky. Everyone was waiting for a great yellow ball of light to peak above the London skyline, the spring equinox, the astronomical start of spring. Perhaps it was because we were gathering to pay attention, or because the urban landscape usually blocks our view. But when the sun made its entrance, it was breathtaking. It did not have its hat on. Small wonder our ancestors were sun worshippers, standing in the presence of a power greater than we can imagine, a power that dictates the cycle of our days. God divided the light from the darkness and called the light day, as the ancient biblical poet put it, and it was morning, the first day. But this was only a rehearsal. For most of us, spring starts tomorrow. The clock surrendering an hour tonight, the mornings rousing us earlier. The practice of pushing time forward, daylight saving, was invented to save resources, less electric lighting. It was doubled to 2 hours in the Second World War and branded British summertime. This weekend coincides with Palm Sunday, when Christians enter Holy Week, the drama leading to Good Friday and Easter Sunday, a story that we get to the light only by moving through the dark. People travelling their days inside faith traditions follow an alternative seasonal calendar, but the religious pilgrimage is always embedded in the planetary one. The date of Easter, for example, set by the full moon after the spring equinox. While the sun seekers on Hackney Marshes now gather 4 mornings a year, 2 equinoxes and 2 solstices, at the other end of the day, a Dutch twilight practice is catching on. Dusking, as it's called, is a ritual to watch the sun go down, a calming transition from day to night. Whether it's the certainty of the sun's rise and fall, or the consoling familiarities in our stories of faith, in shaky days we long for something reliable to hold fast to. In our local parish tomorrow, we start the Palm Sunday service in the church garden, singing a hymn as we process indoors, passers-by looking on as if we're a little out of time, which we usually are. But if faith is personal, it's also, always, public. As G.K. Chesterton once put it, a person can no more have a private religion than they can have a private sun or moon.
That was Thought for the Day with Martin Rowe, writer on culture and spirituality. It's 8 minutes to 8.
Petrol prices are up, rising above £1.50 a litre for the first time in 2 years. The cost of diesel's even higher. Now, the government's previously said it would clamp down on any retailers who tried to rip off customers in light of the rise in oil prices caused by Iran disrupting the flow of global supplies. Now, both the Petrol Retailers Association and Fuels Industry UK say supply here is stable
and there's no need for people to change their buying patterns. Let's talk to Nick Butler, previously head of strategy at BP, former political advisor to Gordon Brown, now visiting professor at King's College London. Morning, Nick.
Good morning.
You're hearing from the industry that they're saying supplies are stable. Are you worried?
I think supplies of petrol are stable. I think I would agree with the warning that was given by the head of Shell this week that there is a developing shortage of some products, particularly diesel and jet fuel in different parts of the world. I think that that is going to be serious. He said that that had begun in Asia and it was going to spread into Europe over the next month. He said the focal point will be the later part of April and early May.
Right. So, and this is because the situation is still unfolding and it's unpredictable, essentially, what is going to happen in the region.
I think there are two reasons. One is it is unpredictable and it's now very clear that this won't be resolved by a political agreement between Mr. Witkoff and the Iranians. This is a real damage to facilities and supplies. The refineries, some refineries have been knocked out. The gas terminal in Qatar has been knocked out. And that will take a long while to put back into order. And so we're going to have a problem over quite an extended period. And then because the refineries are out, those refineries have been producing particular products which are now in short supply around the world. And there's great competition for things like jet fuel has doubled in price because not enough of it is now being produced.
What do you make of the government's warning to fuel companies about ripping off customers? Is that the right target for the government at the moment?
It shouldn't be the only target. I think if people are ripping customers off, they should face the full force of the law. I think that is best done by a forensic audit into their accounts. What are they paying for for the oil or gas that they're selling, and what are they charging for it? And if they're making excess profits, that's wrong. I think really the government should now be coming up with a plan of how they're going to deal with these really serious potential shortages which could develop if this conflict goes on and if Hormuz is not opened pretty soon.
And what should that plan entail?
Well, I think they have to maximise the production of our own resources. I think they have not quite answered the question on doing that, extending the North Sea, the life of the North Sea. That's not an immediate solution, but they should be doing that. And then they have to work out who is going to get whatever resources are available. If supply is cut by 20%, then someone is using 20% less. I think the government has to protect the key sectors of the economy, food supply, health service, schools, and so on. And then it has to work out how it's going to manage the market for the rest of us. I don't think they can just leave it to a free-for-all, which would be chaotic and very regressive and unfair to those of limited ability to pay.
So you're talking about rationing, essentially. I mean, do ministers need to start signposting this as something that could be on the way?
I don't think it's going to be ration books and that sort of rationing. I think it's going to be a lot of countries around the world are now beginning to look at how you gently restrict consumption, driving alternate days for different registration numbers, having an extra day's holiday or a week. That's what some countries in the Far East are doing. Those sort of measures are a form of rationing that will constrain demand in order to bring a new balance with supply for as long as this goes on. I hope they're not necessary, but I think the government now should reassure people by telling them what's going to happen if this situation continues.
And what about the planned rise in fuel duty that's scheduled to come in later this year? I mean, as far as they've gone, they're saying they're keeping that under review. Is that something they should look much more closely at, or at least indicate that they're willing to go there?
I think stopping that should just be part of a wider plan of how they're going to manage the problem. And in the absence of that, the risk is panic buying, which would be terrible. So I think the government have a responsibility to calm the market by showing how they're going to cope with this situation.
Okay, Nick Butler, many thanks. Former head of strategy at BP and former political advisor to Gordon Brown, now visiting professor at King's College London.
BBC Sounds. From hilarious history...
How tall is our King Gilgamesh?
I feel like back then they were just shorter anyway. So I think the lofty height of 5'11".
A giant among men.
To paranormal mystery.
There was a very strong sense of pure distilled evil.
And everything in between.
What are you thinking?
I don't mean generally. I mean on this topic. Yeah. That's not my business.
BBC Sounds. Packed with personality.
2 minutes to 8. Time for a quick look at the weather. Sarah Keith Lucas is with us. Morning, Sarah.
Morning, Leila and Emma. This morning we have got plenty of heavy showers rattling in from the northwest, and it's going to be a chilly feeling day with those brisk winds and some hill snow in the north too. So if you're across Scotland and Northern Ireland, you've probably already seen some heavy showers. Something a little bit drier across the east and southeast of Scotland, but further north and west, the showers are frequent and heavy. So some thunderstorms in the mix, some hail, and over the higher ground, those showers are falling as sleet and snow. There could be 5 to 8 centimetres of snow over the highest ground in Scotland, combined with brisk winds that will gust about 50 to 60 miles an hour, some big waves around the coast as well. And temperatures only 6 to 9, but feeling much colder in the wind. For England and Wales, a different picture here. Many places starting off dry with long spells of blue sky. We've just got one or two showers this morning in the north and the west. But as we head through the day, the showers will become more frequent. So an area of cloud and patchy showery rain will drift south across England and Wales as we head through into the afternoon. The showers will be reasonably hit and miss, but one or two on the heavy side. You might see a bit of hail and temperatures around about 8 to 11 degrees, but again, feeling colder in the wind. Tonight, most of the showers and the winds will ease a little bit. It'll be a cold night for central and eastern areas under those clear skies, but we'll see the next band of rain moving in from the northwest. And don't forget, the clocks go forward 1 hour overnight. Into tomorrow, rain initially in the north and west will push south through the day, followed by sunshine and heavy showers.
Sarah, thanks very much for that. We're hoping for a bit more spring soon, but you are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Leila Nathu and Emma Bonnet.
It's 8 o'clock on Saturday, the 28th of March. The headlines this morning. Israel's military has reported a first missile strike from the Iran-backed Houthis in Yemen as the war enters its second month. We'll have analysis from our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, at 8:10. The drug safety regulator is to review the advice given to patients about certain medications that can cause sex and gambling addictions. And there's a warning that some pregnant women and cancer patients are facing life-threatening delays to ultrasound scans because of a shortage of staff to carry them out.
Also coming up in this hour of the programme, stay with us to hear from the BAFTA award-winning actor. You'll know her from Line of Duty and This Is England, Vicky McClure. She's raising the alarm about the levels of opportunity for working-class actors and production staff in the TV industry. She'll be live on the programme in around half an hour or so. And with the NASA Artemis 2 mission preparing to launch this week, 4 astronauts will soon travel further from Earth than anyone has before.
NASA is ready. This vehicle is definitely ready to go. We went through the flight readiness review. We are ready to launch, but we're also humans trying to load millions of pounds of propellant onto a giant machine and send it to the moon.
Incredible in the true sense of the word. We'll be thinking about all of it, really. How do you prepare for that and what the psychological impact their journey around the moon could have?
I'm Jonathan Ledyard with your Saturday Sport. Tiger Woods has been released from jail after being arrested for driving under the influence near his home in Florida. He was involved in a car crash, but there were no injuries. We'll consider in the next half hour what this means to his career on and off the course.
Jonathan, thank you. But first, the BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
Exactly a month after the start of the Iran war, President Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff has said he's hopeful talks will take place with Tehran in the coming days and that Washington expects an answer to its proposed 15-point peace proposal. Airstrikes have continued across the Gulf, including for the first time a missile launched towards Israel by Houthi militias in Yemen. At least 12 American soldiers are reported to have been wounded in an Iranian strike on a military base in Saudi Arabia. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, James Waterhouse, is monitoring developments.
The BBC's US partner, CBS, has been told that some US soldiers were seriously hurt after the Iranian attack on the Prince Sultan Air Base in Saudi Arabia, which also damaged several refueling aircraft. This mostly aerial war is continuing to be fought in many directions, with Gulf nations again intercepting Iranian-launched missiles and drones overnight. Israel's military has reported a first missile strike from Yemen since the war started, with Iran's Houthi allies threatening to join the fighting. Earlier, Iran claimed two plants, which produce nuclear material, were hit by Israeli airstrikes. Officials there said there was no risk to the public. Donald Trump has again insisted that Iran must open up the Strait of Hormuz, a vital shipping lane, in order to make a peace deal. But it seems the Iranians are intent on continuing to assert their control of the waterway.
World News correspondent Joe Inwood has this analysis of the first month of the war.
A short time ago, the United States military began major combat operations in Iran.
With those words, Donald Trump announced a war that has convulsed the Middle East. He has repeatedly claimed that his original aims to destroy Iran's missile industry, its navy, its regional proxies, and above all its nuclear weapons capabilities are ahead of schedule. The country's supreme leader has been killed, along with many of the regime's top commanders. But Iran has struck back. It has fired thousands of missiles and drones, dragging the entire Gulf into a war that many had worked to prevent. And it is through economic warfare that Iran has arguably done the most damage. By effectively blocking the Strait of Hormuz, through which a fifth of the world's oil usually passes, Tehran has presented a strategic dilemma to which the US does not have an easy answer. And so diplomacy is discussed, although often at cross purposes. Both sides make demands of the other they know they cannot and will not accept. 4 weeks in, the old saying, it is much easier to start a war than end it, has rarely felt truer.
Ukrainian officials say Russian strikes overnight have killed three people and wounded at least 13 others. A drone attack on Ukraine's Odessa region hit a maternity hospital and a residential building, killing one person. In the city of Krivira in central Ukraine, the regional governor said two men were killed in a strike on an industrial facility. The drug safety regulator, the MHRA, says it will review the warnings given to patients who are prescribed some common medications, which can cause impulsive behaviours. Investigations by the BBC have revealed that some people who were taking dopamine agonist drugs for Parkinson's, restless leg syndrome and other conditions developed sex and gambling addictions. The MHRA is looking into the patient leaflets included with eight different drugs. Jane's husband became addicted to pornography and lived what she called a nightmare after taking a drug to treat his Parkinson's. She told us his side effects had been listed as uncommon.
He literally changed overnight into something and someone that I didn't recognise. He was a hardworking man, and he just became a sex addict, I suppose, with very compulsive behaviour, collecting porn snippets and pornography. It was difficult because he couldn't see what the problem was.
The golfer Tiger Woods has been released on bail after he was charged with driving under the influence following a car crash in Florida. The police say the 15 times major champion rolled his SUV while trying to overtake another vehicle. No one was injured. Here's our North America correspondent Peter Bowes.
Tiger Woods was driving near his home on Jupiter Island when the police say he swerved to avoid a collision. Officers at the scene said he showed signs of impairment, but that alcohol was not suspected. Instead, they pointed to the possible influence of medication. Tiger Woods was arrested and taken to jail, where he passed a breath test but refused to provide a urine sample. He was charged with driving under the influence, property damage, and refusal to submit to a lawful test. It's at least the fourth time he's been involved in a car crash. In 2021, he suffered serious leg and ankle injuries in Los Angeles. After years of rehabilitation, the golfer had hoped to return for next month's Masters tournament at Augusta, but that now looks increasingly unlikely.
There's a warning that some pregnant women and cancer patients are facing life-threatening delays to ultrasound scans because of a shortage of staff to carry them out. The latest UK census of sonographers has found that vacancy rates have risen sharply in the past 6 years. Here's our health reporter, Philippa Roxby.
Ultrasound is used to see images of everything from a baby in the womb to muscles and organs, while also helping to diagnose cancers. The Society of Radiographers, which represents sonographers, says demand for ultrasound in healthcare has increased, but there aren't enough people being trained to do the job. In England, where there are just over 1,800 sonographers, one in four posts are currently unfilled. In the southeast of England, 38% of posts are vacant. In the northwest, it's 30%. The government said it was taking action to ensure the NHS had the skilled staff it needed, while rolling out new community diagnostic centres to keep patients away from busy hospitals.
Indonesia has become the first Southeast Asian country to ban under-16s from social media. The ban includes what the Indonesian government defines as high-risk platforms like YouTube and the video game platform Roblox. It says the intention is to combat cyberbullying and addiction. Emails uncovered in the Epstein files reveal a US-based model agent introduced women as young as 18 to the convicted sex offender and pleaded with him to have sex with a model he knew. Ramzi El-Khoury sent Jeffrey Epstein hundreds of emails over almost a decade discussing women, their bodies and their attitudes to sex, often in vulgar terms. Our business correspondent Ben King has been looking through the documents released by the US Department of Justice.
Ramzi El-Khoury apparently wrote to Jeffrey Epstein in 2009 saying he valued his friendship shortly after the American was released from prison for soliciting prostitution. Emails between the pair over the next decade suggest Mr. El-Khoury introduced the financier to a number of young women. One was an 18-year-old Russian student he met in a shop. Mr. El-Khoury says it was to help her find modelling opportunities. In another graphic email chain from 2011, he described a model who was desperate for cash and wrote, "Dear Jeffrey, please just try her in bed." Mr. El-Khoury told the BBC he regretted the language he'd used in some emails and his association with Epstein, and he had not been aware the financier had been abusing women.
Fire crews have been tackling a major blaze at a historic mill building in the centre of Leek in Staffordshire. The Grade 2 listed Big Mill was unoccupied but had planning permission to be turned into flats. People living nearby have been moved from their homes. There are no reports of injuries. Tributes have been paid to Mary Rand, the first British woman to win an Olympic gold medal in athletics after her death at the age of 86. She won three medals at the Tokyo Games in 1964, bronze in the 4x100-metre relay, silver in the pentathlon and gold in the long jump, where she set a new world record.
Wednesday, October 14th, Mary Rand stands poised to jump her way into Olympic history.
Oh, a beautiful jump. It looked to me like the first 22-footer ever by a woman.
A world record, an Olympic record, and a gold medal jump. For the first time ever, a British girl athlete wins an Olympic gold.
I feel that I haven't jumped as far as I can. In training, I've jumped further, and I hope that I can go on next year and improve.
Injury curtailed her career and Mary Rand retired unable to defend her title at the 1968 Games. Anne Packer, who won the 800 metres gold in the same Tokyo Olympics, described her as the most gifted athlete she'd ever seen.
Alan, lovely, incredible to hear that. I love also hearing the commentators saying, a British girl athlete. It's 11 minutes past eight. Today, the 28th of March, marks a month, a whole month since the war in Iran began. And this morning, a concerning development. The Houthis, the group, the armed group, the political armed group in Yemen, have entered the war for the first time. In a statement in the last hour and earlier today, I should say, they declare themselves to be part of what they call the Iranian-led axis of resistance. They have confirmed that they attacked Israel. There are no reports of any casualties or damage in Israel yet, but this could be significant in terms of an escalation in the war, especially at a time when people have been talking about, as we will do shortly, how this war could end. Lise Doucette is the BBC's chief international correspondent. Lise, may we start with mourning who the Houthis are and the significance of this?
So there had been warnings from the Houthis for some time that they could join the war at some point. Their first salvo has been into Israel. It has not been into the Red Sea, but that threat is there. And why is that threat really, really significant? Well, through this past month, and what a month it has been, Emma, The Strait of Hormuz has become a household name now around the world, including here in Britain, because of the stranglehold it has on maritime traffic. Well, another chokehold could become a household name, and it's called the Bab el-Mandeb on the Red Sea. And why is that significant? A little bit less than 10% of global seaborne trade goes through the Bab el-Mandeb. But crucially, it is the last oil corridor for Saudi Arabia. All of Saudi crude oil passes through the Bab el-Mandeb. And between 2023 and 2025, the Houthis attacked commercial vessels going through that strait, disrupting trade. And perhaps some of our listeners may remember at that time, and it's a terrible echo of what is happening now. You heard from 10 Downing Street and from the White House, you must not block ships going through the Bab el-Mandeb. You must stop your attacks. And what was the analysis of all the experts who know the Houthis well? They said, you will just make the Houthis more defiant, which is exactly what happened. Now, after the October ceasefire last year between that the President Trump and his administration helped to broker along with other allies in the Gulf, in the Gaza Strip, the Houthis stopped disrupting trade through the Bab el-Mandeb, but that threat was always there. And so it has come back now to haunt the region and the world. And if they did do it, you can imagine the impact it would have at when there are already economic shocks worldwide because of what's happening in the Strait of Hormuz.
In terms of how disruptive do you think this could be? I mean, you've painted an image of who they are, the wider context, and people have been keen, as we're going to talk about the military side of this in a moment, but, you know, people are keen to talk about the end of this war, at least. Just a brief reflection on what you think this means a month on.
Well, it means it gives yet more proof that the war is escalating, not de-escalating. Yes, President Trump this week gave 10 more days to the Iranians because he said he wanted to give diplomacy a greater chance. There is more passing of messages, no direct talks, no negotiations per se. Pakistan seems to have emerged as the main corridor. The Pakistani foreign minister has now said they may hold meetings in Pakistan of regional leaders to discuss this diplomacy. The main U.S. envoy, Steve Witkoff, said yesterday he thought that the talks were going well. But for Iran and for many others, the Steve Witkoff channel has been burnt. The Iranians see that channel. He led the negotiations in 2025 and this year. Both of them were shattered by U.S.-backed Israeli attacks. The Iranians see the Steve Witkoff channel as a Trojan horse. They also criticize, and there's been quotes from Iranian officials in the last 24 hours saying what is obvious. He very rarely, if ever, brought technical expertise with him. And his style of negotiations, and this is factual, he would arrive and do Iran negotiations in the morning, Ukraine negotiations in the afternoon, and then he would fly back to Washington in the evening. Compare that to the multilateral direct talks between Israel and the United States in 2015, which led to the landmark nuclear deal. Negotiators, including nuclear experts, went to Vienna. They thought it would be 6 days. They stayed negotiating day and night for 22 days. We're not there yet.
Lise Doucette, the BBC's chief international correspondent. Thank you. Well, listening to that and joining us now, General Sir Richard Sheriff, NATO Deputy Supreme Commander from 2011 to 2014. Good morning. Can I start by getting your reaction to the Houthis and the involvement?
I think it was very well described. Firstly, good morning. I think the Houthis joining was well described by one of your earlier correspondents who described it as a nightmare, adding to the nightmare of the blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. So really, really bad news. And I think Lise Doucette described it very well too.
And, you know, we were just talking and starting to come on to the sounds that we're getting out publicly, certainly from the US administration. And, you know, hopeful, Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, saying he's hopeful for meetings with Iran this week. President Trump also saying yesterday the Iranians want to make a deal. What's your view of that and the trust levels?
Well, I don't think you can trust anything coming out of Washington, and you probably can't trust anything coming out of Tehran. And that all adds up to some form of negotiated settlement being very, very remote indeed. And that leaves, I mean, in terms of the future, there are two ways ahead, it seems to me. Either Trump walks away by declaring victory, which of course would not be in any way, shape or form a victory, because he would be leaving behind an Iranian regime damaged, battered, written down, leadership decimated, but angry, vengeful, but most important, holding the Strait of Hormuz. And while Iran holds the Strait of Hormuz, Trump is losing.
You know, in terms of thinking then about if you can't trust Washington and you can't trust what's coming out of Tehran in terms of the information at this moment, how do you look at what's been said, certainly, and in terms of preparation around going in on the ground and the troops that may or may not be required and what could happen? Because, you know, the diplomatic side of things, it doesn't seem to be working at all yet, to say the least, not least with what's just happened.
What's been said, as I said, it's bluff and counterbluff. Let's just focus on the second part of your question, which is the military side. We know that all the reporting says there's a Marine Expeditionary Unit of some 2,500 Marines on its way from Japan. Same again on its way from the United States, California. Reports in the Washington Post yesterday of some 10,000 troops also being deployed. It seems to me that what is happening is, and part of the Trump extending the deadline for what he calls the destruction of Iran's energy capabilities has been extended out to some 10 days. And that all adds up to me to the Americans pausing the negotiations until they've got a military force in place, which gives them options. Very, very difficult options. But it may well be that the only option, if Trump doesn't walk away, is a military operation to force the Strait of Hormuz.
And what does that look like in terms of, is it a naval battle? How does it play out, do you think?
It looks like another nightmare, frankly. It is about as difficult an operation as you could conceive of. Amphibious operations. And history is littered with amphibious operations. I mean, think Gallipoli, for example, in this context, which did not go right. You've got to combine land, sea, and air. You have to land troops on a hostile shore. You've got to be able to secure that hostile shore. And at the same time, the enemy has a vote here. And of course, the Iranians, although, as we said earlier, they've been written down massively militarily. The fact is that every time Trump says their missile capability has been destroyed, in come more missiles, and last night was the same, injuring American military personnel in Saudi Arabia. So they've still got capability. They've still got missiles. They've still got huge numbers of drones. And don't forget, funny old thing, the Russians have been supplying them with drones and with targeting information. So the Iranians still have capability. Do not underestimate them.
Do you think President Trump has underestimated them?
Well, I think the whole operation has been an underestimation. The fact that there appears
to the
have
point
been
to the
no,
point of miscalculation.
Well, the fact that there was no countermeasure put in place to, firstly, by any wargaming would have suggested that the Iranians would launch a regional war in response. Any wargame would say that the Iranians would immediately blockade the Strait of Hormuz. There appears to have been no planning to counter that at all. Americans are playing catch up.
But surely there must have been some planning. You would think that, no?
Well, I am sure that, and I don't know, clearly I don't know, but if there was planning, it wasn't taken account of, it wasn't listened, and measures were not put in place to ensure that the Strait of Hormuz were not blockaded. But let's be clear, it's difficult. It's Geography has a place here. The Iranians are, you know, it is their country. They are holding it. They have capabilities in place. And as part of a preemptive operation, this would have meant an operation to land troops on Iranian soil at the same time as the bombing went in.
Just finally, if I can, is it possible to put a number on what the American forces leading this certainly would need to pull this operation off, do you think?
Well, it depends what you mean by pull the operation off.
Well, it's a broad sentence deliberately, but I'm trying to understand what the operation might mean.
Let's separate out. Securing the Strait of Hormuz, it's one thing to land troops on maybe one or two of the islands on the Iranian shore in order to perhaps run through a convoy, a one-off. And even then, there will be drones coming from hundreds of miles inland. How far inland do you go? That leads to the second operation, which is militarily and politically inconceivable, but I'll say it anyway, which is that Trump says, right, I'm going to march on Tehran, I'm going to topple the regime, and I'm going to occupy Iran. Now that is, and there's a Freudian slip there, because it's a similar operation to what happened in 2003, except on steroids to the power of 10. It would require hundreds of thousands of troops for Trump to do that.
General Sir Richard Sharif, NATO Deputy Supreme Commander from 2011 to 2014, thank you.
It's 23 minutes past 8. It really is the moonshot. Four astronauts in Florida awaiting to begin the mission of their careers, the first crewed journey to the moon in more than 50 years. NASA's Artemis 2 mission will see the astronauts loop around the moon, going further from Earth than anyone has gone before, and they'll be in a spacecraft never before used by humans. Victor Glover, Christina Koch, and Canadian Jeremy Hansen are expected to be in space for 10 days with their commander, Reid Weissman, who spoke at a press conference yesterday in Cape Canaveral.
I think the nation and the world has been waiting a long time to do this again. And on behalf of myself, Victor, Christina, Jeremy, we are really pumped to go do this for this entire team. It has been a lot of work. It's been a great journey. It's great to be down here in the Florida, warm air. The vehicle looked amazing on the pad on the way in. Victor and Christina led us here. It's just been an awesome start.
So they're pumped up for the challenge. But how do astronauts prepare for something as high stakes as this? Susan Charlesworth is a psychologist who spent over a decade training astronauts at the European Space Agency. She's also founder of Charlesworth Human Performance. Susan, good morning.
Good morning.
A massively significant mission for these astronauts. The pressure must be absolutely enormous, and especially for one of them who's actually never been into space before.
Yes, that's right. Jeremy Hansen is the Canadian astronaut, and yes, this will be his first ever flight, so quite a first for him.
The mission's been delayed repeatedly as well, so they've had that to cope with in these years. Just talk us through what they go through in terms of preparations mentally for something like this.
Yes, so they have what we call human behaviour and performance training. So all the astronauts, so I taught the European Space Agency astronauts, but NASA go through a very similar programme. So this is training them on all the psychological skills, so leadership, communication, teamwork, but also problem solving, decision making, situation awareness. So all the, as I said, the psychological skills that they'll need to cope with a mission such as this.
But they have to juggle so many things at the same time, don't they, with something like this, the kind of weight of expectation of the whole mission, the profound experience of being in space, of seeing the Earth from above, and then the very practical reality of just being in a small craft in this very strange existence in such close quarters with only three other people.
Yes, they are going to have to deal with a lot and only got 10 days to do it as well. So yes, obviously they're up there, you know, running the science experiments and doing the research and testing the technology. But from a psychological perspective, as you said, I mean, very high workload, which is going to be very fatiguing. But again, we'll have, you know, they have lots of people on the ground to support them. Their schedules will be, you know, they will be scheduled to the minute of what they will be doing during that 10 days to make sure that they don't become too fatigued and too stressed with that. So they'll plan that very, very carefully. But yes, the effect of being confined, the four of them in a very small space, is going to be very interesting. You know, sleeping, eating, working, everywhere, you know, all in this very small capsule. So
are they selected on the basis of their ability to mentally and emotionally cope with something like this, as well as their physical capabilities?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, all the astronauts are. So they go through a very rigorous selection process. The last European Space Agency astronauts, it was a year and a half of selection. So they are tested, you know, psychologically, a lot of psychometric testing, but also a lot of physical testing and, you know, their health and everything like that as well. But they also come, a lot of them, with, you know, a background in these kind of environments. So they might, you know, not all of them, but some of them are Antarctic explorers, or they have experience of these extreme environments. You know, the astronauts we've got here, most of them, not all of them, but you know, former fighter pilots and test pilots. They're quite used to these sort of very confined environments and taking these sort of risks.
And have you, in your experience, that decade that you spent training with the European Space Agency, have you ever had a situation where an astronaut has had a serious wobble?
None of them have had a serious wobble. We've certainly had serious challenges there. So I was there when the ESA astronaut Luca Parmitano was on a spacewalk and his helmet started filling up with water, which was from his cooling system in the spacesuit. But again, he was, you know, coped perfectly well because of all the training and experience that he had. He was able to get back. This was on the International Space Station. He was able to get back to the airlock safely, and they could deal with that and learn the lessons from that. So we've certainly had our challenges and I, you know, during that 10 years that I was there, but no, the astronauts have never had a wobble.
Well, let's hope these four don't either. Thanks so much, Susan Charlesworth, psychologist and former trainer with the European Space Agency.
It's 29 minutes past eight. Jonathan's back with the latest on the sport. Morning, Jonathan.
Morning again. 10 days before Tiger Woods was hoping to make his competitive comeback to golf by playing in the US Masters, he spent 8 hours in a Florida jail overnight after being arrested for driving under the influence near his home in the state. Woods rolled his SUV after hitting a truck yesterday afternoon. There were no significant injuries for those involved in the crash. Officers hadn't suspected him of being under the influence of alcohol, but possibly by an unknown substance. Sheriff John Budensek in Martin County made this statement to reporters.
So Mr. Woods did a breathalyzer test, blew triple zeros. But when it came time for us to ask for a urinalysis test, he refused. And so he's been charged with DUI, with property damage, and refusal to submit to a lawful test.
Budensek also said that Woods had been cooperative but was trying not to incriminate himself. He had a right to refuse that urine test, but will never get definitive results as to what he was impaired by at the time of the crash. Well, Woods was released on bail this morning, hardly ideal preparation for intense golf practice. Ian Carter, BBC's golf correspondent, has tracked Woods' career through all its dizzying highs and lows and joins us now. Morning.
Good morning, Jonathan.
This is becoming a familiar tale of woe.
It is. It's a familiar low. There's no doubt about that. This is at least the fourth car crash Woods has been involved in since 2009, when he reversed into a fire hydrant outside his Florida home. That prompted revelations that cost him his marriage. In 2017, he was found asleep at the wheel with damage to the right side of his car in Florida. That led to him pleading guilty to reckless driving. And then 5 years ago came a very serious crash when he drove at high speed off a road near Los Angeles and nearly lost his right leg as a result of the injuries that he suffered in that one.
So much of his life, as you've just said and outlined, has been dedicated to battling injuries. How much more can his body take?
Well, that's a good question. You know, injuries have been a big part in his life throughout his career. He's had at least 7 back operations, 5 major knee surgeries, his right leg surgically rebuilt after the 2021 crash, and now he's trying to come back from a ruptured Achilles suffered just over a year ago. He's had 2 further back operations. He blamed that 2017 incident on an adverse reaction to prescription pills. And in this incident, as we've heard, police are alleging that he was impaired, but there was no evidence of any alcohol involved.
And this comes at a time when Woods' significance has been growing off the course rather than on it. What impact is this latest incident going to have on that work?
Yeah, you could argue that he's never been more influential off the golf course. He's chairing the PGA Tour's Future Competitions Committee. He's trying to work out the shape of the tour in the coming years. He's also weighing up whether he would have the time to become the next American Ryder Cup captain in 2027. It would seem he might have other more personal priorities now, with another bleary-eyed mugshot being shown around the world.
Final thought, where does this leave this attempted comeback then?
Well, I think it was already unlikely that he would compete at the Masters, even though he played in an indoor simulator league match earlier this week. He says he's trying to get fit and ready for Augusta. That must now be on the back burner. He's considering playing seniors events now that he has turned 50. But once again, you know, golf does not appear the most important thing in his life at the moment.
Well said. Keep us posted. Ian Carter, BBC Golf Correspondent. Thank you very much indeed. The England head coach, by the way, in football, Thomas Tuchel, declared himself happy and positive about last night's World Cup warm-up with Uruguay, which finished 1-1 at Wembley. And Scotland begin their World Cup preparations with a friend against Japan at Hampden Park tonight.
Jonathan, thanks so much. It is 27 minutes to 9. Adrian Charles is here to tell us what is coming up on this morning's Saturday Live. Morning, Adrian.
Good morning to you from 9 o'clock. We've got a whole hour with three great guests. We've got Dilly Carter from TV Sort Your Life Out, about sort of all about decluttering, organising things. I don't just need her for an hour. I need her for a month at least, I would have thought. I'm looking forward to speaking to her. We've also got the greatest goalkeeper of his generation, Neville Southall, an incredible athlete, and no less impressive to me is the work he's done with marginalised communities, working sort of full time in that area since he stopped playing. He's a fascinating guy, as is Dr. Richard Stevens, who's a psychologist who specialises in swearing. Now, there are obviously broadcasting challenges with that. We're going to be extremely careful. If something does slip out, I'll get my apologies in. I'll get my apologies in beforehand. We're also getting the inheritance tracks of the wonderful Lisa Kudrow. That's all coming up from 9 o'clock on Saturday Live.
Adrian, look forward to hearing how you navigate those swear words. Many thanks.
Always fun on live radio. Let's just have a quick look at the weather. Today will be breezy with sunny spells, variable cloud, and scattered showers drifting in from the northwest. These will be locally thundery and falling wintry over the hills, we're told, in the north.
26 minutes to 9. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Leila Nafu. And Alan Smith has a summary of the news.
For the first time since the war in the Middle East began a month ago, the Iranian-backed Houthi movement in Yemen has launched a missile at Israel, raising the prospect of an expanded conflict. Yesterday, the US Special Envoy Steve Witkoff said he was hopeful that discussions with Tehran would take place in the coming days. Ukraine says three people have been killed and at least 13 others wounded in overnight Russian strikes. The attacks targeted the cities of Odessa and Kyiviria. 8 drugs used to treat conditions like Parkinson's and restless leg syndrome are to have their warnings reviewed by the medicines regulator, the MHRA, after people reported experiencing impulsive behaviours to the BBC. Some developed conditions such as sex and gambling addictions. And there's a warning that some pregnant women and cancer patients are facing life-threatening delays to ultrasound scans because of a shortage of staff to carry them out. The latest UK census of sonographers has found that vacancy rates have risen sharply in the past 6 years.
Alan, thanks very much. It's 25 minutes to 9. Austria has become the latest country to talk of plans of banning children from social media. Of course, it's already happened in Australia. And this week, we've had the landmark trial in the US, where Meta, the parent company of the likes of Instagram and Facebook, and Google, in terms of YouTube as an owner of that, were found guilty of creating platforms that were addictive. And closer to home, our government just yesterday has released guidelines around screen time for children under 5, which, yes, apparently we need. What should be the way forward? As we do on a Saturday, we like to think about things with a bit more space and time on our panel. Hannah Ray's here this week, journalist and writer who worked at Instagram until 2013, and Professor Andrew Shabilsky, Professor of Human Behaviour and Technology at the Oxford Institute. A warm welcome to you both. Good morning this Saturday. Hannah, let me come to you first. It's striking yesterday here in the UK, thinking about under fives, but what do you make of where we've come to and where we should be?
Yeah, hi Emma, good morning. I mean, certainly I think this is the divisive issue among parents today, certainly of my generation. You know, we often talk in conversation and can feel really kind of judged and guilty and worried about getting it right. So, you know, the guidance that came out yesterday is definitely feels like a step in the right direction. I mean, as someone who worked for some of these tech companies, you know, many years ago, it can feel quite delayed, but it's definitely welcome. And certainly the guidance that came out yesterday is very detailed and kind of goes into the nitty gritty of how parents can try and manage kind of healthy screen time habits. So it feels like the right direction.
It wasn't really about management, was it? It was about don't. I mean, you know, an hour or something, but we've been discussing it in the office this morning and it's just trying to understand what that's even based on.
Yeah, and it kind of, you know, it does add some really helpful detail around kind of the types of things that are more useful than others to watch in terms of fast pace and kind of quick transitions between scenes can be overwhelming for young brains. And I think these are the kind of things that parents of very young children are just trying to grapple with, you know, alongside having a very heavy load and often working full time and trying to also understand, you know, be experts in lots of other topics to do with raising their children, like nutrition and behavioral psychology and language development. So expecting parents to also, you know, understand the absolute detail around screen time is a lot. So actually kind of bringing that guidance from evidence-based reporting is really useful.
I know, it's just we were talking about, you know, how you even do a report like that and whether the parents would sign off on some kids sitting there for hours versus other kids not. It's not a precise science, but I take the point about guidance and how helpful that could be. You know, I'm a parent of a three-year-old and an eight-year-old, and there is a lot to navigate. Professor Andrew Shabilsky, let me bring you in at this point. A lot is being made of bans, just banning for children of all ages, or certainly below a certain age. What do you make of that? What, you know, in terms of what you know of human behaviour?
Well, we know. Good morning. Well, we know that bans just don't work. They don't work on the national level. We know this from Chinese and South Korean attempts to ban technology. And they, as a parent, you know, it's really almost impossible to enact bans, at least with our 9 and 12 year olds. And the evidence that the evidence-based review that the government published was excellent. It's backed by scientific studies and by expertise. And I would encourage listeners to go beyond this idea of it just being about limits. I think the really key thing here is about active engagement by parents. Not all screen time is created equal, and you can't just throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Professor Shabilsky, if we say that bans don't work, but we know that there is harmful content on some of these platforms, you're then ending up in a situation where you're relying on the tech companies themselves to do more to take that off. I mean, they've shown, haven't they, that they have no intention of doing that to the extent that's required.
Well, I mean, there's a difference between, what our responsibilities are as parents and, you know, what the responsibilities of tech companies are. It's not that they, you know, want ill for our kids. It's that they simply don't care. And one of the nice things about this report is that it really puts parents at the center of this, not in a way that disempowers them, like that big tech is out to get them, but it kind of gives tractable, easy to follow, you know, fairly straightforward, easy to follow advice that, you know, I really wish that we had had, my wife and I had had, when our kids were under fives.
Do you think that you needed that sort of very simple benchmark in terms of the screen time, for example, just something as simple as that to say 1 hour a day for under fives? Is that actually an effective message?
No, and it's not at all. I mean, and that's why I encourage, you know, you and the listeners to check out the site that the government has set up here. It really is about kind of active engagement. That screen time, like that you spend talking to family over FaceTime, is way different than mindlessly scrolling Instagram or, you know, consuming AI slop. And one of the really important things about the report is that it points out that even, you know, screen time doesn't have the same effect on different kids. You know, we have close friends who have an under five, and he completely melts down with any screen time. And the fact that his mom and his you know, stepdad are on top of that really is that's the social fabric that helps their family get not only day to day, but helps them thrive. And this really needs to be about empowering parents, not giving in to these doom and gloom narratives, which really robs us of agency, because we can't stand up to big tech.
Hannah Ray, listening to that still, you know, you worked at Instagram. Can we stand up to big tech?
It's a tricky question. I think a lot of the intentions, you know, certainly when I worked there were really honest and, you know, wanting to make something that was just more fun and engaging and having no idea of the kind of the way that it would cascade into how, you know, it's being used today. But you know, similar to, you know, what was just being said, I think that there's different types of screen time and there's different types of screen uses, and especially when you're looking at young children under five, and I have a five-year-old and a one-year-old, and, you know, the report goes into detail about it's very different kind of leaving a child with a mobile phone, for example, compared to, you know, as you're saying, like FaceTiming grandparents or, you know, reading something together or sharing that time together. So I think, there's certain types of screen time, and certainly, you know, looking and scrolling Instagram for an hour is probably not good for any brain, you know, let alone it being an under five or not. And that's something that we're just all figuring out together, you know, in this time. And you know, it's just really helpful to have this kind of science-backed reporting and data that can give that ammunition to parents to figure it out, but also for themselves as adults.
Well, Andrew, I think you make a good point as well, just to come back to you, that you know, we should go and read and should we go and engage with that. So there is a bit more agency, certainly. And I was also joking slash not this morning about a friend who used to put her firstborn in front of the washing machine, which is a whole other screen, which seemed to calm him down sitting in his baby bouncer to buy her 5 minutes to have perhaps a cup of tea and do some jobs. But Andrew, just finally to you, if I can, the UK, you know, the government here may go towards a ban. It may happen. And if that happens, do you see that as a nudge rather than something that can actually can work?
I mean, I'm just very skeptical of bans. I think that they give parents like us a false sense of security that our kids are being protected from something. And it absolves us of the responsibility that we have to these young people that we've brought into the world. And we really need to be, you know, there's not so much of a difference between the digital world and the offline world. And we need to be helping shepherd our kids through both. And so it's really a call to action for us to be actively engaged, to not stick our heads in the sand. And screen time absolutely will be bad for some kids. And it will be bad for, you know, one kid on Monday and be great for them on a Friday. And it's really incumbent on us to stay on top of that. And I really think that this advice from the government, it's reliable, it's reasonable, it's revisable, it's flexible for when these platforms change. And we can come back to it to figure out a new way of empowering parents in 2 and 5 years' time. And when we think about bans, that's really just turning off our brains, and we're doing ourselves and our kids a disservice if we treat it like it's a black or white thing.
Professor Andrew Shabilsky, Professor of Human Behaviour and Technology at the Oxford Internet Institute, and Hannah Ray, their journalist and writer, who's got experience of certainly working for one of the big tech firms, Instagram, until 2013. Thank you.
Just to briefly add to that, the on the trial, the judgment in that social media trial in the US, just a quick response from Meta and Google. Meta saying that teen mental health is a profoundly complex issue, cannot be linked to a single app. They are going to continue to defend themselves vigorously, they say, and they remain confident in their record of protecting teens online. And Google says this case misunderstands YouTube, which is responsibly built streaming platform, not a social media site. So you get a sense of the kind of complexities and the kind of arguments there.
It's a 8:45.
Now, in Lebanon, Israel continues its offensive against the Iran-backed group Hezbollah. More than 1 million people have been forced to leave their homes because of evacuation orders issued by Israel ahead of strikes. That equates to around 1 in every 5 people in the country. Shelters are overwhelmed and many families have ended up sleeping in their cars or in makeshift tents, among them children, older people and pregnant women. The BBC's Hugo Bashega has spent the day with some of them.
This is not a school or playground. This is a parking lot on Beirut's waterfront. It's become home to hundreds of families who've been displaced because of the war, with nowhere to go. There's been a heavy storm in Beirut, and people are living here in these flimsy, improvised tents. Many fled in the middle of the night, carrying very little with them. School has been cancelled for the children, and they don't know when or if they'll ever be able to go back home again.
We just want to run, because it's so loud, the sound, yeah.
And dangerous.
Very dangerous.
Obeidi is just 13 years old, and he fled the Dahir with his parents and brother. They've been living in this car park since the start of the war, nearly 4 weeks ago.
How did you feel? Do you remember how you felt when you had to come here?
I feel ashamed.
Why?
I have a house and I live in the street.
How is it here?
Very... not happy in this place.
Do you know how your house is?
Yeah.
Is it okay? Is it there?
It's okay.
Yeah, so you hope to be able to go back?
Yeah.
A few tents down is another family. Sarah is 5 months pregnant. She's here with her one-year-old son and her husband. Unlike Obeidi, their home is no longer standing.
When we came here, they hit our home. Our home is gone. Everything is gone. We don't have anything anymore. I couldn't even get close for my baby. He's wearing my socks. He doesn't even have diapers. Look at the socks. They're oversized.
Over 1 million people have been displaced across Lebanon since the beginning of the war between Israel and Hezbollah. This means 1 in 5 in this country. And around 15% of Lebanon's territory is now under evacuation orders issued by the Israeli military. This has created fear, but also anger.
Old people, elderly people are sleeping on the wood in a soaked tent. I don't care what side we are. If there's a humanity that is above all, anyone should be concerned in this matter.
This is Karim Saad. He's also helping people here since the start of the war. And he says the Lebanese are being neglected.
There's no one helping, especially the people that need the most help. No one else is helping them. Where are the governments, Arab and the European countries who talk about the human rights? Where are they? Where is our government?
Back at the tent set up, aid workers are setting up tarps to help shelter the elderly. Others are bringing food and candies for the children. This could become a major humanitarian crisis in a country that has already suffered so much in recent years. And many of these families may never be able to go back home again.
That was Hugo Bashega reporting.
It's 11 minutes to 9. I mentioned we would be hearing from a BAFTA award-winning actor, and she stepped up to her own line of duty in a bid to champion working-class voices in the TV world, the TV drama world. I'm talking about the line of duty, and this is England star Vicky McClure, who's created a new TV production company with her fellow actor and producer and husband, just that other extra role, Johnny Owen. It's called Build Your Own Films, BYO. Vicky McClure and Johnny Owen join us now. Good morning. I'm hoping we have you there. Oh, I'm so sorry. We will come back to you. That was a bit of an intro. Well, we've whetted your appetites. We'll speak to Vicky and Johnny shortly.
Well, happily, we can talk about something else in our studio. How do you make a hit musical about antimicrobial resistance?
I'm sorry, but I've done all that I can.
Oh, fantastic. A snippet off the song I've Done All That I Can from a new show, Lifeline, about the Scottish scientist Alexander Fleming, who discovered penicillin, of course, and who foresaw
bacterial resistance to antibiotics. It has got a chorus, this musical, including real-life nurses, doctors, vets, dentists and scientists too. Well, Robin Hiley is the co-writer of Lifeline and is here in the studio with us. And I think we do have Dame Sally Davis, who was chief medical officer between 2010 and 2019 and also a chief scientific advisor at the Department of Health, who is also involved with this musical. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Very happy to have you here, Robin, especially in the studio. Why antibiotics?
Well, I was approached by an infectious diseases doctor who is a sort of a family friend back in 2017 with this idea about her work of creating a piece to disseminate this big problem that we all need to know about.
Right. Okay. And talk me through how you went from that initial kernel of an idea to, well, a glorious example of what we heard there.
Well, I was initially slightly suspect about whether it could be a good topic for a musical, but I quickly got hooked on the life of Fleming, which is more than just the famous discovery that lots of us learnt about at school in 1928. His connection with the two world wars, how antibiotics completely changed sort of the outlook of healthcare, and a warning that he made to us all when he got his Nobel Prize in 1945, which we need to take heed of here and now.
So you've got essentially a musical with a public health message. Something we don't really get often, that sort of a combination. But you've woven in a bit of a human story about him as well.
Absolutely. It's at its heart human stories. And it's not just human stories about Alexander Fleming. It's a present day human story as well, which we got to hear about through this Greek chorus of scientists and healthcare professionals that we put in the show. And indeed, the whole thing is a celebration of the work of the people that we champion and give voice to.
Sally, can I come to you? How did you get involved with this production?
Well, I heard that it had been sellout at the Edinburgh Festival for 3 weeks, so I got to see it, and I was absolutely thrilled. After all, the arts can help explain complexity, science and medicine to all of us, and they draw us in. And, I mean, hats off to Robin. He's done a wonderful job. It develops all the time. And it really humanizes science, using this power of the story and song to translate the complex message that we have to look after the antibiotics, the anti-infectives, antifungals we've got, or they won't work. And then not only will people die, just imagine meningitis if the antibiotics didn't work. People will die and our food chain will not work properly. This is a real threat to humanity. And we can all take little steps. And they're in the songs. They're in this production. Come and see it.
So, this is a serious issue that you think people aren't, taking seriously enough. And you think that this sort of a way of presenting it can have an impact where normal public health messaging can't.
Well, we see that public health messaging is essential, but doesn't get through to everyone. And actually, we get a bit bored with it from time to time, having been the one that put it over. So new ways to bring people in are just wonderful. And this really has singable songs. Children can sing them at school and learn that they need to wash their hands before they cook, after the lavatory. Learn the value of vaccines. Learn to look after antibiotics.
Thanks so much, Dame Sally Davis there, former Chief Medical Officer, and Robin Hiley, Lifeline co-writer. Thanks so much to you both. And I should say Lifeline is running until the 2nd of May at the Southwark Playhouse here in London.
Right, well, let's stick with the drama, and hopefully the drama of the phone lines won't let me down again. Vicky McClure and Johnny Owen are on the line. Good morning.
Good morning, Emma.
Hello. Good. Well, No. This is the joy and the art of live broadcasting and creativity. You've put together a new production firm, Build Your Own Films, and it's born of a genuine concern. Vicky, let me come to you first, and I'll come to you, Johnny. Yeah. Hello to both of you, I should say. But Vicky, why have you felt so moved to do this? What is the problem?
I suppose it's based on my own experience. I went to the TV workshop in Nottingham, famous for many people that have come out of it, Jack O'Connell, Samantha Morton, just to name but a few. And it was free, you know, in my day. Mm-hmm. So there was no paywall to sort of create that barrier to follow what I wanted to do. And I just don't see that now. That's not around in the regions. And I think it's all about trying to find out where these opportunities lie for the youngsters and for, you know, working class kids that can't afford the drama school fees and can't afford to, you know, do the London trips or at least even try and potentially live in London to start their careers. It's so expensive. So where are we, you know, where are we setting up the workshops? And I think the production company, myself and Johnny, you know, we met making a film together. So we're born in that world. And we're both from working class backgrounds where we go, how are we getting those stories onto screen? So it's, you know, about giving opportunities, but also about giving the audience the variety of life. We want to see those stories.
Johnny, the morning, the stories, but also to get those actors through and the production staff through from a variety of backgrounds. How are you going to do that latter part?
It's very, very difficult, Emma. I'm becoming more and more difficult. I mean, just show my age here, but when I started 30 years ago now, nearly in HTV, that station doesn't even exist anymore. Giant studios outside Cardiff, full of different departments, drama, light end, current affairs, shiny floors, hundreds of jobs, all gone. That's what I came through, and that's where people like Michael Sheen, Rob Brydon, all started there. And Vicky just mentioned the TV workshop that was sponsored by Central Television, also gone. So this is about keeping those avenues open, because the TV and media world, as you know better than anybody, the radio world, has changed so much this last decade especially. So what do we do? How do we keep those avenues open? And when me and Vicky formed BYO, we didn't have to do it. We were sort of okay, we were doing fine, but we thought, let's try and do something, you know, the opus operandi of this, you know, was to try and create something for working class people. And I started this little furor by this week answering a question where a journalist said to me, oh, you must be inundated with commissions and offers and drama. And I said, no, we haven't had any yet. And then this has kind of blown up since. And, you know, if me and Vicky are finding it difficult, then we just want to say how difficult it must be for a lot of people. And it's creating those opportunities, you know, and keeping them open. Yes. I mean, the BBC is a great example, Emma, you know, and ITV, where I come from. I make documentaries, and the thing people, I always say to people that stops them dead, and they talk about, well, it's a changing world. Where are the archives going to come from Netflix and others, or Apple or Prime? They're not there. This is why the BBC is super important. It documents the way we are.
Yeah, of course. It does, and it captures those moments in time. And we, you know, nothing is more popular than on the BBC social media feeds when they play some archive of how people spoke in the 60s, the 70s, and all of that. Vicky, just quickly before we finish, can I come back to you? What is the problem if we don't keep it that we have people from all backgrounds, especially working class backgrounds, which is your focus, coming through? What happens on sets, do you think, and storytelling?
Well, I mean, you know, Adolescence is a great example of a show that's taken on a global audience. You can't have that kind of show if you don't have people that have lived experience. You know, these shows require authenticity in its performance, in its writing, in its production to get it completely right, to get it to the point where it is those kind of shows. And, you know, James Graham, I know, speaks about this issue as well. And he's from not far down the road from me in Nottingham, you know, puns.